This episode is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. Find over 20 million stock photos, vectors, illustrations, and video clips. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code WeekendConfirmed9.
T minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Weekend confirmed.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
Welcome to Weekend Confirmed, everybody. And this is a, well, this is a special Tokyo Game Show edition from Santa Monica, California. Yeah. First time in 7 years. I'm not there, so you know. Actually, I went a little shopping before coming into the studio and brought the best part of this year's Tokyo Game Show into the studio. That would be Japanese beer. Yay! Hooray!
Beer. Hooray! Beer.
Double fisting.
Which sort of is a sad statement on the show, but I honestly think that like the best thing you could get there is probably Japanese beer, because you know what. You guys already knew this, so I had this surprise planned for the rest of the group here, but like they already knew this, is that there is no Japanese beer in America.
It's like Kobe beef.
Yeah, it's like Kobe beef. Our imported Sapporo beer is actually brewed in Ontario, but it's brewed in Canada because that way they can put imported on the label. Unlike Kirin or Asahi, which are both brewed in Los Angeles.
Yeah, arigato, eh?
Yeah. Under license. Yeah, one's by Miller, one's by Bud. Anyway, it's like, I didn't know about this until I started reading up, and I was like, oh, so I have to go to the Mitsuo market and then like prowl through the bottles and go like, oh, does this one say brewed in Japan on it? All right, cool.
I recently introduced I recently discovered Hitachino. Jeff Rubenstein also like recently discovered it.
Excellent.
Pretty yummy, but I have no idea if that's actually imported or not.
There's another one, I think it's called Orion, that is evidently also brewed in Japan. Mm-hmm. And if you can find Abisu, which I hear you can get sometimes at Mitsuwa, it's only made in, only brewed in Japan, so it has to be imported. Anyway, kanpai, everybody.
Yeah, kanpai.
Tokyo Game kanpai. Show.
Kanpai. Cheers, l'chaim, all that other
there
stuff.
There you go.
Kanbei.
It is a Jewish holiday week.
Mm-hmm.
So on the show today, obviously, Mr. Kanata still away at his play. By the way, if you are going to be in Southern California, you should look out for that. He'll be in a performance of Noises Off for the next 3 weekends. But he will be back here starting next week because his rigorous rehearsal schedule is complete. Sitting in his chair, though, is James Stevenson.
Hey, hey. How's it going?
Here to explain to me why Fuse is not Haze.
Oh wow! Yeah, that's. Can you believe that? Fuse is Haze. Says the guy who didn't actually make the trip up to Insomniac last week to check it out.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I still love you, but But it was pretty close about the non-loving after the Fuse Haze mark.
Jeez. I know. So I brought that up because I wanted to apologize, because that was a little ridiculously harsh. That was one of those radio moments where I sort of went over the top, which I never ever do.
No.
But I'd like to apologize because that was a little far. And like I said, on the Daily Show, you guys do have a great history for making the game mechanic part great. Intihar was not happy with me either.
No, yeah, he was a little upset. But you know what? I mean, it'll be okay.
Mr. Andrew Yoon is here as well.
Howdy.
Well, you guys are going to be excited because Andrew was both in New York for the Wii U event. So he is here to stalwartly defend Nintendo's next generation console.
Wait, is that really what I'm here for?
Then after that, he was in Seattle where he played Halo 4. So, yeah, right now you're probably incredibly jealous of this man. He's got it all. And then there's Indie Jeff Mattis at the end of the table.
How's it going? Oh, I just want to give a shout-out to Kanata again and wish him luck with his stunt that he's doing in the play. And hopefully he
don't
will not
wish him
be,
luck.
Break a leg.
Break a leg.
Yes.
Good but, Lord.
Yeah, specifically with the stunt.
It's like you don't live in Los Angeles or something.
Yeah,
that's true. It's like they teach that to you when you get your driver's license here. Like, and whatever you do, if you talk to an actor, never wish them
luck. Oh, the worst part is I went to UCLA Theater School.
Oh.
All right, so we're going to do Tokyo Game Show. We're going to revisit the Wii U, of course, because you guys were none too happy with us about that. And then we're also going to talk about some FTL, which is this awesome indie game.
So good.
It's so good.
Fucking good. You got to download it.
Can't wait to tell stories about this. Highly recommend
that. Is that the sequel to FML? No.
No.
Okay.
But I did have one of my guys who's
it
like,
it does not have KMFDM.
He's like, I gotta download this For the Lost game. I'm like, what do you mean this For the Lost game? He's like, this game called For the Lost. I'm like, FTL? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, No, it's not for the loss. Come on.
It's faster than light.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So we got that.
Come on,
we got
nerds.
Yeah, right.
And all of us are engrossed in our addiction to Borderlands 2. We've got the BioWare doctors retiring, so we got a lot to get to. We will jump right into TGS. The lone big thing was, I guess, the Sony press conference prior to the start of the show, at which the super slim PS3 was announced. It's the Sliminator. Slim.
The Slimmy McSlim?
Slimmy McSlim. It's 25% lighter than the new Slim and 50% lighter than the original, because your shelves will be so much happier now.
I mean, if Square Enix named it, it would be PlayStation 3-3.
So, are you sure it would be PlayStation 3-III?
So what's the official?
It would have some unpronounceable word after that.
Do we actually have an official name on this model?
The
PlayStation
Super Slim.
3.
Is it the Super Slim?
Oh, it is
really
the Super Slim?
No. Officially, it's still just PlayStation 3.
No, I'm calling
3.
It the Super Slim. That is the official name. I want to call it the Super Slim.
The Slim Pickens.
It's like the iPad. Pickens. It's like iPad 3.
Yeah. Exactly. That would be pretty thin.
But like Andrew was saying, actually, it does supersede the all prior models. And funny enough, as we're going to talk about here in a second, is they're not discounting or offering any incentives to pick up the old ones. And by the way, when you see the new one, depending on how you roll, you may want to pick up one of the old ones before they're gone.
I would recommend just picking up one of the older ones while you can, you know?
Yeah.
That new one is pretty ugly.
All right, so let's just jump right in and talk about the aesthetics. If you haven't seen it yet, it basically is a cylinder stretched along one axis and ribbed on the top for enjoyment.
As soon as you said ribbed, I started giggling.
I knew that's why I decided to finish it for you. Now, the part of what we didn't understand was, if you haven't seen, and they've been, I thought it was interesting that they didn't show a lot of shots of this right off the bat, is the way the thing opens is if you're looking down on the top of this thing and you're looking at it across, laid out in front of you as it would sit on your shelf, the right side, the right half side of the top slides over the left top side and reveals the disc tray. And it's not electronic. It's not like an elegant motion at all. As a matter of fact, it's a very kind of IGN Europe evidently already got one, and they had the unboxing video of it that we were watching, and it's like, it's not the nicest sounding piece of kit.
Will it continue to play once you accidentally rip the door off?
I don't know if you'd rip the door off. Oh, that's interesting. PlayStation 1000s. Remember the old
trick? Yeah, you had just a paperclip and you could swap any disc in.
Yeah.
Those were the good old days.
Oh, man. I wonder if that means modders will have fun with this.
Depends on the system, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, so one thing that's very clear about this, as it was held up next to even the Slim, is that they've obviously economized the interior of it tremendously. And so I think that it is, I'm a little disappointed that there wasn't a better price move on it, because it's clearly a efficiency redesign. They're obviously, I mean, look, these machines are 7-8 years old now. The industrial design, the internals design, like all the stuff that's on the circuit board
is getting smaller and smaller
and much more efficiently made and stuff. I mean, look, like if you were to go out, what was the iPhone of the era? When was iPhone even out when PlayStation 3 came out?
7 years ago almost now. So you're talking 2006. I mean, like what, Samsung Blackjack type phone was this sort of thing? Oh.
People still had Sidekicks.
Yeah, or Razors, the original Razors, the Motorola Razors.
So what I'm saying is, think about the tremendous efficiencies that have been improved upon in manufacturing. So you can make this thing for a lot less money.
I mean, they have Vitas now. Let's not forget.
They have Vitas.
Well, it's sort of interesting, too, because it's like, you know, obviously you've had some industrial they have to have some industrial designers over there, full time. So, the two things that interest me is, A, it's weird that they didn't rip off Apple more. Like, it feels like everyone's ripping off Apple these days and trying to make stuff look like it's an Apple product. And they kind of went exactly the opposite of that, which I think is kind of interesting. And then the secondary thing is, obviously, it's just like, you know, it's been so long. You know, it's almost like you don't have anything else for these guys to do without a new console. So, hey, well, redesign the PlayStation 3 again, guys, and make it cheaper. Yeah. And that's going to make us some money. And so it doesn't really surprise me.
That part does make a lot of sense. Because of the financial difficulties they've had, making a more efficient to manufacture, more cost-efficient design, I bet the retooling realistically didn't cost that much money. Honestly, the plastic molding, is that a big expense?
No, it's just always the setup cost.
The setup, right.
Know, like, it's a lot to get to that point. But now once it's being made, I'm sure it's much cheaper.
Right, which goes back to this thing of the pricing on it. And so in North America, there's going to be two editions of this. there's going to be a $270 bundle that includes Uncharted 3 and $30 worth of credit for Dust 514. This is the weirdest combination of things and price points that I would just never have predicted. It raises this fall, with Wii U coming into the space at $300, they raised their entry-level price from $250 to $270.
Now, do you think they did that because they want to be able to drop that as soon as they need to, once, you know,
No, because this was the time to announce it. I mean, you're at the time to announce your holiday stuff.
Yeah,
this is your holiday...
Yeah, yeah.
No, this is your holiday push.
And besides, it would be so confusing if they dropped the price right after launching it. I wouldn't know what to do.
And you're probably not planning on dropping the price after launch. You probably already have all your holiday. I mean, we always start to see this is like when Black Friday and all that shit starts to leak out. So obviously,
they probably have
these sales already well planned out of, oh, you know, you're going to be able to get it for $199 or whatever on Black Friday from this store, and those units are being made with whatever bundled games they're going to do this year.
I mean, last year's Black Friday was crazy, right?
Mm-hmm. So I guess that's a fair point. I think there'll be some sales on Black Friday where maybe you'll see it for, so it's $269.
There's a $249 without the games, right?
No, they're not releasing that in North America.
There's no $250.
Oh, wow. So it's only $269 here. I thought it was coming out $249. Wow, that is interesting.
It's $270 in North America or $300 for a 500 gigabyte, but it doesn't have a games.
But they're also releasing the Assassin's Creed 3 bundle, which they haven't priced yet.
Do you think that's them not? I mean, here's the interesting thing. Do you think if Microsoft had cut the price on the Xbox, mm-hmm. do you think they would have cut the price? Or is it one of these things where they're like, well, we could cut the price, but Microsoft hasn't cut the price, so we might as well keep ours up too?
Well, I think Microsoft's sort of in the driver's seat now. Microsoft, of course, did not attend Tokyo Game Show, so didn't feel any need to do a press conference or have any sort of announcements. They're still sort of in this position. So now, I sort of imagine that there's this evil corporate battle going on at Microsoft right now between two factions. One faction that's saying, look, Sony didn't lower their price. There's no reason for us to lower our price. We're already in the commanding position in this generation. We have great products to talk about. We've got a great story to tell with our Sesame Street and National Geographic Connect products. We've got Halo 4. The last thing we need to do is lower the price this holiday. And then the other side is saying, are you kidding me? We've got Halo 4. We've got all this family stuff. We cut the price by $50 and we've got everybody by the jugular.
But do you really care about market share at this point? Like, I mean, as we kind of approach what is assumed to be the close of a generation, like, I mean, are you just kind of like, oh, well, we'll make what money we can off of the boxes we made?
When do you not care about market share?
I think both companies probably are so focused on profitability right now that, I mean, it's a terrible economy still.
That is true. It is a tough economy.
And dropping $50 on each Xbox is $50 on each Xbox that they could have made.
And or considering how many Xboxes they think they probably will sell this holiday, which I would imagine a shit ton. Like,
they're
getting into
selling
millions
out no
and millions of dollars, in theory, if you drop the price $50.
But go the other way. Conversely, Nintendo's selling machine this year, this fall, at home unit, is a $300
But you're not going to be able to buy one.
Yeah, I think no one is really that concerned about the Wii U.
No, I think I mean look how fast pre-order sold out. Like, the Wii U is going to be gone.
There'll be another wave of them.
Sure, but what, two waves before Christmas?
I think one of the reasons why their announcement was so late, in comparison to their launches, there really aren't going to be many units this fiscal year.
For Wii U,
just because I don't think Nintendo like really foresaw how difficult it would be to not only make the system but also to make the tablet.
Yeah, the controller. Definitely the controller poses some issues. So you guys are okay with them going $270 with the Uncharted and Dust? $30 worth of digital goods for Dust?
That's a really weird pack-in, but it's cool.
Uncharted's a brilliant pack-in, though, obviously. I mean,
I think it's a missed opportunity for them.
That's a good way to put it. I'm not mad at them. I mean, don't misinterpret it, because people seem to like have late been, why are you mad, bro? I'm not mad. I think the door was really open for PlayStation to capitalize on the now really impressive first party exclusive lineup that they have assembled behind the PS3 to come in with a $200 machine and just really clean up. I think they could have been dominant.
And you look at too, like, even just the HD collections that they've, that new collections line, they've rebranded it. You have like the Killzone one coming out. You had our PS2 Ratchets come out. Obviously, the God of War package with five games in it. the Journey one, you assume like their other collections will probably get kind of repackaged.
And
too.
PlayStation Plus. Like imagine right. a 250 system, a redesigned
with
system,
a year of PS
which
Plus.
Had a year of PlayStation yeah. Plus. And the marketing is you buy this and you don't even have to buy games for a year.
Like there's,
that would have been another way to approach it. That would have been really cool, too. That think, would actually be a really cool way
I mean,
to approach it as well.
I think, I mean, Plus has been marketed solely towards the hardcore gamer, but, like, if they reposition the marketing, you go after the casuals.
I think and you feel like they have a little bit, too, with that, like, here's your instant game library was kind of the big thing, and there's, like, 10 free games in Plus, and if you download them now, you'll always have those games as long as you keep being on Plus. Like, hey, that $50 for that first year looks pretty good, if they, especially if they've rotated in and mm-hmm. they continue to rotate in new games. You might get 15, 16 free full games.
One thing that, you know, hardware holders love to talk about is attach rate, which is the number of games sold against the number of consoles sold. And I think that if they had gone to a less expensive approach with all these HD collections that they have, because those HD collections are going to appeal to gamers who have been wanting the machine but haven't had a chance to get it yet, and they are already value priced relative to a $60 mm-hmm. sure. game, right?
Yeah. Do you think they're sort of hedging their bets because they're like, okay, well,
I think
here we are
late
in the generation. We got a new console that we can sell. We could sell for cheaper, but we don't know that the attach rate's going to be what it was.
No, I don't think so. I think they were making a move based on we really need to shore up profitability, mm-hmm. and we don't think we can sell enough more at $200 to justify taking the price down, and we've got the manufacturing cost down to X, whatever it's down to now, and we know that we can make a really good margin on them, and even if we don't sell as many, we're happy because we're going to make more money off of them.
Right. That's one of two ways you go, right? You're either trying to make a killing on the hardware or the software, and it's hard to get.
And I think
both.
They could.
Well, they may have. And even if you just look at the pure profitability, I mean, I'm assuming somewhere Bean Counter did look at it and say, well, based on how many games this person who's buying a PlayStation 3 at this point in the life cycle is going to buy during the rest of the PlayStation 3's life cycle, does that justify the $50 hit as well, all those extra mm-hmm. people? And
right.
maybe
but it's
it
funny,
doesn't.
They used to so well understand this, because if you look at how they were so good at sustaining the sales momentum of their consoles through price cuts on PlayStation 1 and PlayStation 2, especially PlayStation 1, man. They held on to that price for so long. When PlayStation 1 finally went $99, it exploded all over again. Right. It was like, holy crap, the machine is forever ancient. No one's making any new games for it, but it's $99.
Yeah.
People are going to buy them.
I mean, you're targeting like the Big Lots crowd, you know,
yeah.
at that point.
But I mean, it's true, though, that even every... that is true.
No. I'm just saying, you know, you're going away from GameStop and Toys R Us, and you're going towards a completely different consumer.
And maybe I'm not making the point. Well, I think that there's stratification of the market, where at every price point that you come down, you open mm-hmm. that floor to a new consumer.
Sure.
And $199 is definitely a new line that they could have gotten into.
I think, if anything, it's indicative that maybe PlayStation 4 is just a lot further away than
I thought
think
that
it
too.
Is,
you know? You convinced me. Like, I didn't think it. You convinced me. It's a good argument.
Yeah.
And maybe that's because they've like made an assertion of where they think Microsoft's hardware is, and they don't think that they're competitive and they're back to the drawing board. Or maybe it's because they want to save money because they have financial troubles and just want to hold right now, and they don't want to run the setup costs. I don't know. Sony's vice president of marketing, handhelds and home consoles, John Kohler, told Engadget that he told them this about the pricing. It's one of the craziest marketing person speak I've ever heard. There's been so many retail price promotions and so many different gift card offers and all those things being done by all of us that we've heard from our consumer, enough with all these weird price moves. What we really want is content and games and value.
So here's another model.
And here's a bundle.
Yeah.
And we're raising the price because value evidently does not equate to lowering the price. It's not the value is we give you more stuff and confuse you. It's like they should be selling cars.
It's not to sell it to you for $200. It's to make it worth $300 to you.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. On the box, it's on the new box, it says, you know, over $70 of savings, you know?
Of course. So. Of course.
It is a weird message.
I'm really curious to see how holiday consumers approach this. And I mean, you guys out there who say things, I'm really curious. I haven't seen yet. I wonder what Pactor's response is to this. I wonder what the financial investment side of the world's response to like this sort of pricing.
I mean, I think there is some merit to what he's saying, though, considering when you look at the Wii U pre-orders, the $350 version sold out much more quickly than the $300 version. So
Yeah.
But it's a new
it's a brand new piece of kit.
It's a brand new kit. You got all the core fans immediately like, you know, so well, I'm going to get it.
And the bigger one was a better value, too. Like, that was the obvious value.
Oh, yeah.
So, you, of course, you go for the one that's $50 more. If you're laying out $300 for a game and the extra space.
I just don't think Sony's trying to go after the same market that Xbox is with the $99 Xbox or the, you know, 4 gigabyte system.
$199 Xbox.
Well, no, the subsidized one.
Oh, the subsidized one.
And that's but there's the interesting part about that too. In Europe, they do have like what's the flash only one, right?
The 12 gigabyte,
12 gigs 12 of flash.
Gigabyte, that's $199. Is that right?
Equivalent American dollars would be like $199. So.
Yeah, because there's always like the same amount of euros, but
you have to counter.
Well, right, and some of this is jockeying because of the fluctuations in currency, of course, and the strength of the Japanese yen as it continues to hold like really, really strong.
Yeah, that also hurts. I mean, that also hurts American pricing for
pricing and it hurts
Japanese
them.
Company.
Yeah. So, some of you guys' comments on the aesthetic. Shacker Dodob said, "It looks like a Bose from the 90s.
That's funny.
It does sort of.
It's a little bit true.
So the thing is very tiny. It is, if you've seen the Slim, it is not as deep as the Slim even. So it is a much reduced footprint. Does anyone really care, though, about it being smaller and lighter? It sits on your shelf. Who cares? Why does that matter?
I think there's probably some wives out there, and there's some, you know, people that like the aesthetics of... I mean, I definitely feel like the aesthetics of the Slim, the first Slim, was, like, much nicer. It looks much nicer sitting on your shelf than the old giant bulky
one. Yeah, and compare the new Xbox compared to the original one.
Yep,
you know,
another great example.
Love the redesign.
The redesigned Xbox does look great, but I would say that sitting next to... Because I just got my home theater receiver, finally. And so I have my cabinet set up. And having them in there, I actually sort of... I mean, the new Xbox looks good. It's nice, clean, has that black piano, black finish. The nice thing about the original PlayStation is it had that same, like, audio-grade piano black finish on it. And so, yes, it is a little monolithic in its, like, hulking shape sitting there. It still looks like it fits in. The Slim has that matte plastic finish, and this seems to appear as
it doesn't look as high-end, but I do appreciate the size. I mean, I honestly do. Like, I think smaller is always a little bit better.
No,
I totally
appreciate it, too. I don't know that it's going to be a selling point, per se. Like, I mean, that may be another incentive to, like, this is another reason to get one, but I don't know that...
Well, I mean, I think the really interesting thing about being a PlayStation consumer is that if you got the original system, like, you were really rewarded over the entire, like, console generation. Because every iteration of that hardware has been worse than, like, you paid $600 and you got a second job to, like, please Ken Kutaragi. But damn it, you got your money's worth, you know?
Yeah.
You got your backwards compatibility. You got your 4 USB ports, you know?
Yeah.
Though now I prefer, I mean, I have a 60 and a Slim, and I prefer the Slim now because it's so much quieter.
Yeah, that's
so.
I've actually
quieter.
Been thinking about, now, especially with them going away, I've been thinking about getting a Slim because my 60 is pretty noisy.
And it's terrible for watching movies or shit.
It is. It's like, awful it's like for Blu-rays, but I got to, anyway, that's a whole lot of stuff. We're not getting into that. Geek Deck said, and Sony just gave a huge gift to Nintendo, re-releasing a half-decade old console with the cheapest package, still more expensive than the cheapest version of Nintendo's new console.
I don't get that. I mean, like, Nintendo...
He missed a little bit. The Nintendo console is going to be actually a little bit more expensive. I said $300.
Right. Well, I mean, and the whole thing is, it's more expensive. But it's already sold out. Like, the Nintendo console is sold out. It doesn't matter what Sony does. Every Wii U that is on shelves this holiday is gone.
It's going to sell.
And that's probably the case into January, February. So, I mean, maybe. Now we start talking about March and beyond. Who knows? But who knows what Sony will do with the price March and beyond? They might drop it after the holiday. They may not. I don't have any foreknowledge there, so don't take it as that. But
they're dropping the price.
Yeah. I honestly have no clue. They don't tell me on shit like
what?
That.
What? PlayStation's going free?
God damn it. I guess my point here is that it doesn't really affect Nintendo. Nintendo doesn't really have much of an effect on the marketplace. Nintendo affects Sony, but whatever Sony and Microsoft do don't really affect Nintendo this holiday because they're such a core group that will buy that hardware that it doesn't matter.
So what else do we have? There's going to be a Red and Blue Vita released for Japan this fall. We'll never see them here, of course.
No.
We will see a white one alongside Assassin's Creed. What's it called?
Liberation.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So we get a white Vita here. Would red and blue, is that even going to matter to Americans? I mean, obviously.
Well,
we had
did you hear that Reggie Fils-Aimé quote where he said white hardware doesn't sell? Or
oh yeah, he did. He just specifically was like, we're not bringing a white one out because it doesn't sell very well. Pink sells better than white.
Mm. My iPhone says hi. Mm. I'm all about white.
And their whole last console was white, but
yeah, and their Wii U is also white.
So, they have a white version of that too.
Interesting. And of course, Japan got a tremendous number of beautiful colors on PSPs. I don't know if you like ever saw any, like
oh,
the emerald green, and oh my god, those leads look awesome. They look really good. And their PSP got a price cut to only $170. It's amazing. They still sell PSPs so well there. So amazingly well.
People are using them though.
Yeah,
yeah. Absolutely. There's a market.
What else did we learn? Kingdom Hearts is getting a huge, crazy HD remix remaster for PS3. It's called Kingdom Hearts 1.5 HD Remix. It has a remastered version of Kingdom Hearts Final Mix, which is, if you follow the Kingdom Hearts series, they do like many of those Square titles, they do like an international version, and then they wrap it all up in like the Super Ultimate Mega Mix Fantastic version, and that will be the one that is getting HD treatment here for Kingdom Hearts. It also includes Chain of Memories, which was a GBA game, but it was also converted into 3D for PS2. So they'll be taking the PS2 version and upraising that to HD. And then there's the DS game 358 Two Days that they are also including in this, but only the cutscenes.
Yeah, for the theater mode.
Yes.
Supposedly not playable. I just want to say I hope everyone who's a big Kingdom Hearts fan likes waiting, because I think it was about this time last year or even earlier last year when they announced Final Fantasy X HD,
yeah.
And we still don't have that shit.
And that's not so. And that's just an HD remix. It's not even a remake, you know? They right. don't have to do anything to it.
So yeah, good luck. Yeah. I'll believe that when I have the copy of it in my
The story
freaking
says it's coming out in 2013 in Japan.
Sure.
What? It's coming out in 2013.
Where's my Final Fantasy X HD, goddammit?
Especially for Vita, I want that on Vita.
Are you really gonna? Are you gonna replay Final Fantasy X?
No, I just was noting because. But actually, it was funny because I showed this to Intihar, and if you know Brian Intihar, he's a giant Kingdom Hearts freak.
Oh yeah.
And the first thing he's like, "Where the fuck is Kingdom Hearts 2?" And I was like,
"That's for Kingdom Hearts 2.5."
Wow, you know what?
HD
when he and Ariel meet, I expect them to just go like nerd out for about half an hour.
They're
going to
instantly cosplay. They're going to meet each other and then instantly they're like, oh, whoa,
giant zippers! Like, where the hell did these come from?
It's going to be bizarre because you know she loves the Kingdom Hearts, like loves, especially 2. I'm sure that her response tonight will be, wait, it's not 2? What?
How did that go again?
That's exasperation.
I think the sound of exasperation.
So what else do we pick up on? As was announced at Gamescom, PS Plus will be out on Vita this fall. It hits in November. No additional charge for current subscribers, so we can be happy about that. You're also going to get instant games as you get on PS3, although no word yet on exactly how that'll work. And you'll get an extra gig of storage. Is that really going to help the Vita?
Because Vita has no games, God.
I mean, does it help you buy?
It's gonna Persona in November.
That's
November.
That is pretty awesome.
I mean, I'm still playing PSP games on my Vita, so I'm perfectly okay with that. I'm okay with playing PS1 games and you know PSP games and the occasional Vita game on that system.
That Persona 4 Gold Edition looks awesome.
Yeah, I want Persona 4. Well,
and I think this helps convert some of those PS3 PS Plus because it's a good amount. And it's like, hey, look, like you've already got this, so you already pay for PS Plus. You have all these Vita games you're not taking advantage of. Why don't you just go out and buy Vitas? So
you're going to buy PlayStation All-Stars, and you're getting the PS Vita version
and
for
and
free.
Full Frontal Assault and Sly 4, like a bunch of these games. Like, you can play it out of your house, and you can cross-save, and storage helps.
They're finally doing what I hoped that they would do from the very beginning, was just make Vita the greatest PlayStation 3 accessory ever, you know?
It's like a gamepad.
It is like a gamepad.
Except it has back touch.
And multi-touch.
Oh, my gosh. We're not going to even get into Wii U yet, because when we come back on the other side, we still have a few more Tokyo Game Show loose ends to tie up. We've got all of that and more when Weekend Confirm continues.
This episode is brought to you by Shutterstock.com with over 20 million stock photos, vectors, illustrations, and video clips. If you're looking for images for your website or blog, print ads, trade show swag, or even apps, Shutterstock is the way to go. Over 10,000 new images are added each day. With Shutterstock.com, you get a global image collection. You can find images from across the world to suit whatever project. You can choose between image packs and monthly subscription packages. Choose whatever fits your needs and never have to compromise. And if you just need one image for your blog or mock-up, you can do that too. Sign up for free. Go to Shutterstock.com. Sign up for a free account. No credit card is needed. And when you find the images you like and decide to purchase, use offer code WeekendConfirmed9 and get 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com and use offer code WeekendConfirmed9.
All right. There is even more. Well, that was a really clean transition, wasn't it? I'm going to just blow it, screw it up, and boom, do my own mistakes. I blame the beer. There's more goodness for PlayStation Plus owners out there. Starhawk, which came out earlier this year, and I have to say, like, it's really interesting the relationships that you develop as someone in the media covering studios, like with the studios. Some of them you just sort of get this like vibe off of, and Lightbox is definitely one of those studios that just has this, like, they have a really cool energy around them. They're super into what they're doing. They have a tremendous degree of passion for what they're making, and I was super pulling for them with Starhawk, and it makes me so happy that they're getting a second lease on this game, because it's a good game. I had it, and I'm equally as guilty of not having played it, because it's sitting on my shelf in the foil as well, so I should go play it. But here's what the deal is. If you are a PlayStation Plus owner, starting next Tuesday, you will be able to get the Starhawk single-player campaign for free. It is a full game on demand, single-player campaign for your PlayStation Plus-itude.
That's pretty awesome.
That is very awesome.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, I think that some people sort of look at it as just a trainer for multiplayer, but I remember from like watching the development of this, like the single player campaign in this game is very cool. It has a lot of, it's not going to set the world on fire, but it's
for free.
For free. It's also, it's the sort of thing you can go back and play and play and play, because it brings out the strategy tactics game of the game very strongly. And so that means that, you know, you can jump in and play it number of times and get different results and have fun with it. Anyway, I think that's really awesome. The multiplayer will be available for anybody for $20. So
that's also awesome.
If you were a Warhawk player who were like not turned on at $60 for Starhawk, but you wanted to play the multiplayer, now you can just go out and grab the game for $20 and play all the multiplayer you want to. If you're Plus, you'll get both for $20. And then they're also going to do a digital version for $39.99 with single player and multiplayer if you don't happen to be a PlayStation Plus owner. So I think that's a really cool deal that they did there.
Also, all the DLC for that game has been free in terms of map packs, you know.
And they're doing another one. And along with all this, they're doing another DLC drop with 3 more modes and 5 more maps. So, like, here's like the studio that's like, whatever, you guys aren't playing it. We're just going to make more. This is a really good game. We know you'll like it. So please come play it.
Mm-hmm.
I applaud that. That's really, I hope they are successful with it. We also learned a little more about, and I'm going to ruin this name, Yaiba.
Yaiba,
which is Inafune's new game. And guess what? It's also Team Ninja's new game, because it's Yaiba Ninja Gaiden Z. And it stars a fallen ninja who's been resurrected as a cyborg to take out his killer, who was Ryu Hayabusa.
Of course.
Small complaint. I just wish they didn't call it Z, because it looks a little bit too much like Sigma. So, like, you know, just when you have the box art next to each other, it'll just be like,
it's okay. Sigma 2 is coming to Vita. Also announced. So what do you guys think about this? It's crazy. It's Inafune working with Tecmo's Team Ninja to make this crazy side story about a cyborg ninja in a zombie-infested world whose job is to hunt down Ryu and kill him.
It's kind of cool. It sounds kind of Suda51-ish, sort of, but yeah.
Yeah, it seems a little too crazy.
Yeah.
I feel like they run the risk of the same problem that, like, Lollipop Chainsaw had, where, like, oh, look at all these crazy ideas, but it didn't really feel cohesive, you know?
Yeah. James, what do you think?
I can play it on my Vita.
great.
I don't know if you can play it on your Vita.
I don't know.
It looks like you're not enthused by it. Are you a Ninja Gaiden guy?
I am. I don't know. I haven't really been, though, since, like, I don't know, kind of.
Well, Ninja Gaiden 3 was by most people's standards who aren't hip-hop gamer, a miss.
Yeah, and that's I never really felt the need to play it.
He loves it. I don't know, dude. Hip-hop gamer loves Ninja Gaiden 3.
Hip-hop gamer loves everything, though.
I love the first two, you know, Xbox ones, just in this generation. But it's just, like, the third one, like, I saw it. I never really, like, I don't know if I got my fill on the first couple. And
it's possible.
It, but I never really felt a humongous, oh my god, I must play this game desire. And so it's kind of like, all right, we'll see how it does when it gets a little bit closer. It's still way too early to tell, but I'm not chomping at the bit yet.
I'm kind of in love with the whole theme and crazy video.
You're
and
sort of all about the over-the-top crazy
oh, yeah,
weird
I love,
shit
I love
right
it.
Now.
I love over-the-top shit. I'm all about the over-the-top.
By the way, you should play Lollipop Chainsaw. Gameplay aside, it's worth it.
Yeah?
You would get a kick out of it. If you like his other stuff, you really. I was laughing my way through it. So
I think I'm honestly, I mean, in that same type of genre, I don't know, maybe these aren't the same, but would you put Bayonetta in that same type of genre game?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm more excited about Bayonetta 2 than I am this, for sure.
I'm amazed Bayonetta 2. Bayonetta 2 is even a thing, like that, and not only that, it's a Nintendo thing. That's like even more bizarre to me, you know?
Well, I wasn't going to move to Wii U yet, but I will say this about Bayonetta 2, if this didn't come across clearly last time. One of the things that is significant about Nintendo's move with Wii U into a more core gaming market is that picking up and saving a game like Bayonetta 2 suddenly makes sense. You know, A, we've got the hardware for it, but B, also, hey, we're trying to reach out to this community. Here's a game that's not going to get made unless we go in and subsidize it and support its being made, support its development. And we can do that now because it makes sense, because we want to get into that market again. And so that's a very cool thing. And they don't really have much to worry about as far as support, because Monster Hunter 4.
At least in Japan.
Riccardi's like tweeting from the floor at TGS. He's like, just finished my second play. I'm like, Jesus Christ, dude. And they have like the pavilion laid out again, and it looks super ambitious. And here we are still thinking, oh, well, we'll be excited because we get Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate next spring, hopefully, 2013.
Really, it really is bizarre that there is a game like that still in Japan. You know, like a game that doesn't come here. Like that used to be a thing, like when we were kids or younger. Like, God damn it, that game is never going to come out over here. Like Mother 3 and like shit like that. We're like, ah, oh, I really just want to play this, and Japan gets it and we don't. And Monster Hunter has that weird same vibe where it's like, oh, the Japanese people get to play it for years before we do.
And then when we get it, it just misses, like, it doesn't connect, and we don't build that same culture around it.
Granted, you know, there's all these American games that don't connect over there, you know, like Call of Duty.
Funny you should say that, actually, because just last night, Ariel and I were talking about TGS, and she was telling me the story about how, so if you're unfamiliar with this, Activision games are
published
by Square Enix in Japan, right? So, and Ariel's a fluent Japanese speaker, so she tells me a story about how last year we're standing there, it was several years ago. She's standing there at the Square booth watching all the trailers, and the trailer for Modern Warfare 2 comes up.
Three.
No, there was two, because it's like a long time ago.
Okay.
So the trailer for Modern Warfare 2 comes up, and she's like watching it, and she's stunned because the two guys who are in front of her, Japanese guys, are like, oh man, I can't wait till this comes out. I can't wait to play this. And the other guy was like, yeah, this is going to be so good, and we're going to all be playing it, or something like that. And I'm like, really? The stereotype shattered.
Well, no, I mean, there is a very dedicated community of, you know, Western game playing folks in Japan, you know, and they're the ones that have an Xbox and prefer Xbox over PlayStation or Nintendo.
So she just happened to be standing behind two of the 8,000 people that bought launch day 360s.
Well, I'm sure you could stand in the line at a Best Buy here at some point and hear a couple people going, oh, I can't wait to play Persona 4 on Vita, you know?
Yeah, like, it's the same thing. It's the flip version of that.
Yeah.
It just seems weird, but still, because you're talking about a game everyone here plays.
Yeah, and you're at TGS. Anyway.
Granted, I think Square Enix has done a really good job of trying to bring these Activision games to the Japanese market. They've been really aggressive in their marketing.
Is Skylanders popular over there?
You know, I have no idea. It's been a while since I've been in Japan, but
it feels like it should be, right? Like, Skylander seems like something that would work well in Japan. Maybe not, maybe because there's so much consumerism around the toys, but even that feels like it should work really well in Japan.
Their design is a little westernized as well. And plus, like, how hard would it be to unseat Pokemon there? I mean, even more difficult than here, I think.
Yeah, but, maybe. I mean, the toy collectible market is so strong in Japan. That's far really more than here, you know?
Like, the game is secondary, and they all have Wiis, so, you know, or even DSs to play with it.
You don't have to tell me. You're talking to a guy who, like, walks into every damn hobby shop when he's in Tokyo and buys, like, a couple of those collectible toy boxes, and, like, I wonder which one I'm going to get this time, because you open the box.
Damn it, it's not the one that I wanted!
So. Yeah. I just can't leave. I cannot drag myself to like Mandalake and then buy like the ones that are already opened. Where it's,
I always get the ones that are always open.
It kind of takes the fun away.
No, there's no fun in opening it and be like, oh man, I got the toilet.
What do they cost?
Why does this set of Gundam characters come with a toilet? I don't know.
That's the super ultra rare one.
It's true.
What do those set you back for a mystery box?
Oh, they're not bad. They're like
$8,
yeah,
$10, you know.
Yeah, like 650 yen or something. So
yeah, that's fun.
Yeah. Anyway, so last week we talked about the Wii U, and it seems only appropriate we follow Monster Hunter. Monster Hunter 3 is coming out next year for 3DS and Wii U here. Monster Hunter 3 has already been out in Japan for a year. It's been incredibly successful. I'd be curious to see how that does here, if that's finally the version that clicks it over. We've learned that the 3DS version is not going to be updated to have online multiplayer, but you will have local multiplayer and the ability to interface with a Wii U locally. So you'll be able to play in a group setting like that. So some of the things that you guys called us to the mat about, and we're going to start, since we already talked about pricing, we might as well get that out of the way first. A lot of you guys were on us for saying that the Wii U at $300 for the base set and $350 for the deluxe was expensive. I still feel like at $300, the base Wii U is a fairly expensive proposition, although I feel like I probably was only looking at it from the standpoint of the game content and the console hardware, not the gamepad. And factoring in the gamepad, I appreciate the argument you guys out there made about $300
reasonable. What's the point of having a tablet that you can't use on the go, though? Like the value it costs a lot to make the gamepad, but functionally, it's not an iPad. Functionally, it's not even a Kindle Fire. I don't think having the tablet makes it a greater value.
But I think the point they're trying to make is that the cost is higher, so obviously the price would be higher, regardless of whether or not the value is there. But I mean, I think too, you're still looking at a product, at least for the first holiday season, that's going to be scarce.
Yes.
So even if it's a $250 thing, why wouldn't you charge $300 if you know you're going to sell them for $300? You can always cut that price.
And Nintendo always makes money on their hardware.
And we all know value is subjective, right? So, and to Garnet's point, a lot of the reason, sort of my lack of enthusiasm for it at this point, is largely based on software, right? So it's like I see myself getting one of these things eventually if Nintendo does what it normally does, and once a new Metroid game comes out and a new Zelda game comes out and a Mario game
They're all in Nintendo Land. You're getting 12 brand new experiences, 12 full games in one disc.
But there is a new Mario game, a new side-scrolling Mario game coming out that has some Super Mario World feel to it. I'm kind of geeked out about that right off the top. You didn't pre-order one.
No, I mean, it sold out before I even could think about it.
See, there are games on there that I'm interested in that I will definitely pick up once I have the console, but Mario and Rayman and the Lego thing and Bayonetta 2, none of those things are giving me that inner core you must play this.
But since you were here last week, broken down, I mean, I think I've been swayed some by the argument that yes, $300 it was just the base unit would be expensive, but $300 for the base unit and this gamepad that has a touchscreen in it and has a bunch of functionality, that is different than anything else that's out there, is a more palatable number.
But you're paying for potential.
How do you feel about it?
You're paying for potential at that
point. You are paying. I agree.
And I don't, I get it. I've bought things that hadn't sort of borne themselves out in the market.
It's like buying an Android phone.
Well, right. Not really. For me, it's all about what am I going to be doing on this thing? Maybe playing games on it, right, primarily. Mm-hmm. So what games do they have? I look at the spread of games, and just on a personal level, most of the stuff on there I've either played or it looks interesting, but not enough for me to go reach into my wallet and pull out $400.
So, James, you pre-ordered one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as soon as that press conference is over and it was GameStop's pre-ordering, and the nice thing was being on the West Coast where it was GameStop's pre-ordering today. People on the East Coast started pre-ordering. Ours weren't open yet. I'm showering. I go to GameStop. I check their website. It opens at 9. I get there about 9:30.
I like how you're moving your arms as you're moving.
I'm gesturing. I'm walking in, all excited. It was actually 9:15. I get there. No, it's still closed. I'm oh, that sucks. So I went to Starbucks and I sat there.
Oh, you went to a physical store?
I ordered in person at the one right by the Insomniac office because I figure, I'm going to be there. Plus, the problem in fucking Nintendo, they bring their shit out on Sunday.
Yeah.
So you can't actually get it delivered on that day. So if I want it that day... And I mean, I don't necessarily. Do I really need it the day it comes out? No,
yes.
I don't.
Yes,
I,
you do.
I don't really. But on
this
the
from
same
the man
token,
who's saying I got my iPhone 5 by 10:30 a.m.
tomorrow. Yeah, it's true. Or today, by the time you listen to this. But But I guess my point going back to this is, yeah, I know I'm going to want it eventually. So why not get it now?
Because there's a price drop coming at some point, and maybe at that point will coincide with other software that
maybe
sort
it does
or
maybe it doesn't. My biggest issue is if there's stuff that I even kind of want to play right now, if I wait, the chances of me playing that later on are far less. Am I going to go back to New Super Mario U or Rayman?
12 months from now when the price drop and the 3D Zelda game comes out, and that's what I really was waiting to buy the system, there's going to be stuff that I miss. So I'd rather just have it now, play the stuff when I want to play it. If it's $50 less, okay, fine, I'm out $50. But mm-hmm. I got to play those games when I wanted to play them.
My question to you then would be, you know, if you – do you really want to play those games if that's sort of your – like if, you don't, if you're not going to go back and play them – you know, when you did have a console, like if you bought it in the future as opposed to now, are they really that compelling to you, or is it just like I want to be the first?
I think that with a lot of games, there's a sense of time and place that's important to them. You know, when fair. You play a game like Borderlands right now, when lots of people are playing it and going through co-op, or you play a game like Demon's Souls when it's first coming out and there's a lot of messages being left, mm-hmm. or Chrome Hounds when it had a really good community. I'm just pulling that out of my ass. I don't know why Chrome Hounds came to mind, but my point is there are certain games that
the Che, you know, Army,
when that moment comes around and that game is out and it's fresh and people are talking about it and you can engage other people about it and they're playing it, there's definitely a better sense. I enjoy that more. And that's not to say the game won't age well, but I definitely think certain games have a great moment where they are at their best and almost like in a wine or something where it's like, this is the right time to play this game.
It's valid.
And it may not make as much sense on the Wii U since multiplayer and online community isn't as big a part of it, but there will be something to playing through the new Mario U or playing through Rayman Legends or playing through Zombie U with a lot of other people that are really excited to play those games. And I think that maybe isn't as big during launch because you're going to have 6-8 months of people buying Wii U's and buying those early launch games. So maybe that's a little bit more spread out at launch. But I'm really excited about it, even if those games aren't necessarily like, oh my God, it's going to be the most exciting thing ever.
I was just going to say, hearing you say that, just to respond, that's actually not – I mean, I totally get that. Like, and I think what it boils down to me is I think that way and then I go, okay, do I have $500 or $400 of disposable income that I can just, you know, vaporize right now and do that? And it's like
and that's the thing. There's a value to me of that that makes me willing to spend that $300, $350 on the system, $35 in tax, $100 on two more games. And God, Stone, please send me the Ubisoft stuff because that's most of the things I want. But like, so there's definitely, I agree with you, that cost is a big cost. And that seems like a value to me. I guess I don't even question new hardware at a certain point because I play so many games that it's like, by the time I play 25, 30 games, it was $10 a game on that. If I play that few games over the course of the life of that system, and it's kind of like, it's just the sunk cost. I'm so used to buying new hardware that I don't even really, I just want it. And mm-hmm. and I want it so I can have it day one, and I want it so I can play it day one, and all those intrinsic things have that value to me. And I understand that's not the case for everyone, especially in a holiday like this where there's a lot of – I mean, by the time the Wii U hits, you'll have Halo in your machine. You'll have Call of Duty in your machine. You'll have Assassin's Creed in your machine. Like, there's a lot of really good shit coming out in October and November. So do you really care if you're not playing new Mario Wii U and you wait 8-9 months to play it?
It's up to you. Maybe not. One thing I think that will definitely help with the perception of what value you got out of it is how powerful the box turns out to be. And Nintendo's always very good at being, you know, very deceptive, or not deceptive, that implies something negative, but very good about not being like, well, here's the exact, they don't want to get into like a tech battle because they've never been into like a big tech battle. But it's clear the Wii U has very powerful, by current standard, hardware inside there. How powerful do you think it is? Last week, you know, we took a lot of heat because people were saying, oh, well, it is next gen. I'm going to stand by what I said, that even allowing for different manners in which you define, air quotes, next gen, that the Wii U is more of a top tier Xbox 360 PS3 caliber machine than a next gen machine.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with the Wii U being the last of the current generation.
Nothing at all. And that's not disparaging. I think that the only thing that suffers from, and this was what I was trying to allude to in that conversation, was that just like the PS3 hasn't really benefited from its marginal improvement over the 360, and depending on who you talk to, there's different pluses or minuses there. But there are definitely people who would say, like, hey, the PS3 is a little more powerful because you're making a multi-platform game. You need to work on everything. The Wii U could get stuck in that same boat.
I mean, the odd thing that I see with a lot of Nintendo Defense Force people is that we had this conversation 5 years ago when the Wii mm-hmm. came out. It's like, you know, it's going to be so much more powerful than a PlayStation 2 and an Xbox One, you know? And I remember people actually saying, like, you know, I know it's in standard definition, but the games are going to look just as good as on PS3 and 360 because, like, you know, with the tech that they have, not rendering all those pixels means that the quality of the image in standard definition will look as good as a 360 and PS3. And I'm like...
Yeah, and we all know...
That's a real reality, logic.
Yeah. Yes, yes. And I'm just so baffled by the fact that they're going back to that argument again. I mean, the thing is when...
So tech arguments aside, you saw a number of games in New York visually and just feel of playing them. What do you think about the power of the machine?
I mean...
Tell me about some of the games.
I mean, the fact that their big announcement, other than their price and release date, was that they were having Call of Duty Black Ops 2. I don't think... I mean, that's a big deal, yes, but... I mean, the fact that the big bullet point for that was, like, the first time we've been able to have platform parity on a Call of Duty game.
And they had it there, right?
Yeah, they had it there.
And so, how'd it look?
I mean, it looked like Call of Duty Black Ops 2. I mean, and to be fair... I mean, the console is powerful enough that it can render the image twice. So it's rendering one console.
That's cool.
Is rendering, you know, it full 720p, 60 frames per
second.
And
what was it like
on
the
TV
and the other
one and on the tablet? And I mean, you know, I'm still not exactly sure how Nintendo pulled it off, but there's really no latency on the controllers. So you know, for a genre where that's so important, you know, it's just really impressive that the controller is able to do that. But, I mean, honestly, the screen doesn't look that great. You know, you look at...
How so?
I mean, it looks like a pretty old LCD, you know? It doesn't really... You know, it doesn't look
it's
like...
It's not a Vita screen. It's not an OLED.
It's definitely not an OLED screen.
Right.
And that,
but I mean,
and,
I don't think that means it looks bad.
No, it doesn't look bad. I mean, it's certainly playable. It felt a lot more comfortable to me than playing split screen, for example. I definitely prefer playing... With the Wii U gamepad, like it feels comfortable. I prefer that over playing split screen. No matter how big your TV is, I think just
split screen is always
having
crunched.
A line in the middle of the TV.
Aspect ratio is like highly underestimated in terms of the value of that. Like having a consistent.
So you know, I think that's really impressive.
But going back to the original point, and you point out, like, okay, it looks probably as good as the Xbox PS3 version, maybe a little better, but certainly within range. And yes, it's a powerful piece of hardware because it's rendering a TV screen and it's also rendering a gamepad, which is sucking up some of the extra power this thing has. But it's not like you're already... I mean, if this really was... And the question was, is it a next-gen machine in beyond the PlayStation 3 and Xbox? It doesn't seem like it is. From every game I've seen demo, nothing has me go, oh, that is a clear step up from the current pieces of hardware. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but I'm just saying, like, if you in that argument of, oh, this is the next generation of power and fidelity, yeah, maybe it's more powerful, but it's using it to power a gamepad and catch up.
I mean, the thing is, right now, there is no PlayStation 4 and there is no, you know, Xbox, whatever the next one is.
Right.
And there's so therefore, we don't really have, you know, an accurate comparison, but I mean, you know, because obviously the Xbox 360 came out before the Wii.
And I think it sort of depends on whether you buy into Carmack's philosophy, you know, that he talked about at QuakeCon of, like, you have no idea how much we're going to blow you away. Like, don't think that we're done blowing you away because the next generation of graphics.
Yeah, he's talking orders of magnitude.
Right. Like, he always talks about that. But then, I mean, and maybe this is because I feel like already so impressed with where games have come. I look at a Wii U, Xbox 360, PS3 game on a 1080p HD set of you know, like whatever the fall titles are, like a Halo 4, and go, this game looks ridiculous. Like, how do you really show me something that makes me go jaw-droppingly, wow, that's next gen?
I mean, Halo 4, I mean, I was consistently impressed that it was on a current generation machine. Just like the fact that they've squeeze that much power out of existing hardware is just mind-boggling.
You'll get some more graphical fidelity, but I think the next big leap is going to be in the behind-the-scenes stuff, like physics processing and AI.
So hard to show people.
Well, it is until you play a game where you're like, "Holy fuck!"
I mean, think about Watch Dogs or whatever. Like, people were crazy impressed by Watch Dogs. And, yeah, the visuals were good.
What about Star Wars 1313, too? I mean, we're assuming that is not running on PlayStation 3 and Xbox hardware at this point. And that game looks, I mean, it looks better than anything you've seen running on.
Or, yeah, and, well, remember the Metal Gear Ground Zeroes demo? Unique.
Yeah.
I still have to, like, find, there's no way that's actually on current gen.
The engine's scalable. Engine scalable.
I mean,
however, if you've seen Borderlands on PC versus Borderlands on,
so pretty.
Yeah, so this is really interesting, especially if you happen to have NVIDIA's PhysX technology, because then you get all kinds of really cool particle effects and environmental effects around, you know, like air vortices and water, and it can do all of those neat things where like stuff's moving around very organically. And that actually makes a big difference in the way the game looks.
Can I just say, just to interject really quick, Borderlands 2 has made a insane improvement over the first game in terms of PC options for PC gamers. It is ridiculous. I mean, you can modify anything in there, and
it's going from being a terrible port to being legit, the best version
like,
of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is the better version. I mean, like, I've been playing it on Steam and like 1080p, like uncapped frame rate, everything turned up to high. I do think that Borderlands art style doesn't lend itself to cranking that out of the PC, which, like, there are points where you're like, yeah, this probably would look pretty much similar on an Xbox. Like, it's not going to look that much better. And I think some of their art style has held back what a PC version of that could
be. It's weird
be.
Because I think you wouldn't – you think that, but then if I side-by-sided the same scene, you'd be like, oh, shit.
Like, view distance in particular.
Yeah, maybe that's...
But once again, these are, like, really subtle things that I don't think matter to, like, 80% of consumers
out
there.
Whereas, I guess my larger point is, I don't necessarily... I'm like, yeah, this looks good, and it looks competent. Like, whereas when I play Spec Ops on PC maxed out, you're like, damn, like, there's some stuff in there that you know your Xbox wouldn't do. And you
yeah,
see
Sleeping
that,
Dogs PC is a completely different game.
Oh, yeah, with the high-res texture. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's stuff like that I think doesn't quite stand. Borderlands isn't necessarily the best high-end PC example. That said, it certainly looks better and runs better on a high-end PC. And, I mean, that's the way to play it. If you have a high-end PC, you should be playing it on Steam.
If it wasn't Black Ops 2, what stood out to you at the New York event for Wii U? What would you go, wow, Wii U, really powerful hardware. This looks great.
Nothing.
No, come on.
No, seriously.
Now people are just going to be mad again. I don't want another week of this.
I mean, the last Wii U game that I played that really impressed me was FIFA 13.
Really? I mean, I'm not that surprised. I mean, they put a lot of work into FIFA, but...
Yeah, no, I mean, just the stuff that you can do with the touchpad is, like, really, just really inventive. And I'd love to see more of that. It has the same, you know, visually, we're talking platform parity again. It's not, it doesn't look better. And I don't really care. I don't really care if games look better on the Wii U or not. And I think people really should stop defending Nintendo on that point, you know?
As far as the touchpad in FIFA 13 goes, folks, if you're wondering about it, one of the things you can do, for instance, is when you want to start a run, you can use the touchpad to trace your wingman's run so that you can have him lead down the field and be ready for your through pass.
I also love just being able to aim where I kick. When you like shake the controller and you want to you kick, you actually get an image of the goal post and you actually can aim, like literally touch where you want to aim.
You can finally do a high pressure kick, you know, put a lot of effort into a kick and keep it low into the left or low into the right. Yeah, it's
kind of
crazy.
And they actually really open up a lot of interesting gameplay possibilities where, like, oh, you're just a casual player, you just want to like have an overview of the map and like just touch players and like draw lines for them. You can play it that way. You want to ignore that, just you play with the gamepad and ignore the touchscreen entirely. Yeah. You can play like that too. I think that's definitely been the most impressive thing I've seen in terms of the gamepad integration.
Did you play the new Rayman?
At E3.
That was the one thing that I played that I was like, oh, okay, I get it. This is actually pretty cool.
At E3, that was my Wii U game of the show. And it's just beautiful. You know? Yeah. It's beautiful. I mean, that's a solid game. And I remember when we were playing it at E3, I was like, how are they going to bring this to other consoles? And, I mean, so far they haven't announced any other version.
Well, you'd have to – I mean, the touchpad functionality for that is you know – outdoes even new Super Mario U in terms of what they're doing with it. It's just...
Yeah, I mean, I know you're excited for new Super Mario U, but...
Well, that and Rayman are the two big ones. Like,
but I am sort of burned out on the new Super Mario franchise after playing 2 and, like, just having another one come out, like, right on the heels of that. I feel like I'm new Super Mario'd out.
It's got a new suit.
Yes, it has the squirrel suit.
Yeah, I think the big thing for me is it's got more of that world flavor that I'm kind of excited about, like bringing more of Super Mario World and having sort of a sequel to that or a game that pulls from that more is what excites me and kind of gets me reinvigorated.
Versus the Mario 3 route.
Yeah, I'm a little over the Mario 3 route because it's been done to death. But in a Mario World, if it's true with the Yoshis and all that sort of stuff that they keep showing, like I think that hopefully will be a little bit fresher. But I can understand where you're coming from on that.
I think that one thing you guys are bringing out is there are titles that are higher tier than what I like. Those aren't super pulling me. Like, maybe that's part of my little bit of reluctance with the Wii U. Like, right now, the things I'm most excited about are Pikmin 3 and the 101. And I don't think that either of those are going to really set the world on fire. But for
and
me,
neither of them are launch games.
And neither of them are launch games.
So yeah,
they might be launch games though.
They might be launch games,
but you never know.
I mean, so far the launch lineup just doesn't excite me, because the third, like, are you really going to be excited for Mass Effect 3 on Wii U? As a Nintendo fan, like, yeah, it's great that you finally have access to this franchise, but you're missing out on the first two games, you know? Are you really excited to get into Darksiders 2 without playing the first one? Are
Assassin's Creed 3 or...
Yeah, you know, like, I mean, like it's finally allowing Nintendo fans that haven't jumped into any other console cycle to finally experience these franchises that we've been playing for years. But, like, for me, there's no incentive to really get the Wii U version of Assassin's Creed 3.
So what you're saying is they can get on the BioWare train just in time for the bloody smash into the cliff as the doctors depart.
Oh, you're really forcing that segue.
Wow.
You're really forcing that transition.
I hopped on right at the right moment, right before we went to break. And when we come back on the other side, we can discuss whether or not we think there's a future for BioWare. And we'll talk about some of the games we've been playing, including Borderlands 2, FTL, and I don't know what else. Stick around. We'll be right back with the second half of Week in Confirmed. Sounds from Dave there with the synth mode for our break. All right, so as my provocative comment got us started, the BioWare doctors both, probably mutually agreed to, resigned from BioWare this past week. So
5 years after they signed that contract with EA, really bizarre. Odd timing.
Are you saying you think that that was the term of agreed upon how long they would stay?
I'm just saying they just left exactly 5 years afterwards. It's just
both
weird.
Of them at the same time.
Yeah, it's just really, yeah. Really bizarre.
So I think my big concern out of this is that I feel like there's a lot of pent up fan frustration with BioWare's most recent games. Mass Effect 3 only over the ending, but I think it could get some spillover. Dragon Age 2, where they went with that game, and then obviously Star Wars, which has been, you know, the brunt of much attention already. With the doctors going, I think that there's a chance that, well, not a chance, I just don't think I'd want to be around BioWare for whatever their next game is, because I could see the backlash coming. Like, if it's not a surprise, amaze, oh my god, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen kind of game, people just be like, well, that's it, they're done. Because, like, you know, game fans are fickle.
I mean, two people don't make a game, though.
Well, and you know, you could argue or wonder, speculate how much real involvement they've had over the past couple of projects. I mean, they've been there, they've been, you know, but like how much are they actually directing?
So
these?
I would guess that they probably aren't. You know, it's not like, oh, who's going to program this now and they're gone, or who's going to do this. But what I would assume is that, given their high level and their high level inside of EA, that those guys act as a very strong advocate for the studio, mm-hmm. and for, yes. the creative decisions of the studio inside of EA as a whole. And I would assume that that would be where, you know, the team would probably be most concerned, is you have these guys who are managing all of this. You have these guys that had their back and would fight for them as the top executives for really the entire BioWare label. So a lot of power there. And with that sort of vacuum now, and I don't think they've said who's taking over the BioWare label, you know, that is where...
Or for that matter, what's going to happen with it. I mean, with those two guys who are really the identity of BioWare, the brand, leaving, how many of the ancillary BioWare EA facilities...
Like Mythic and Victory.
Yeah, I mean, do they stay I mean, if you're
That's
EA,
a good question, actually.
If you're EA and you look at it now, how do you decide what to do with those properties, and how do you decide what to do with BioWare? I don't think BioWare is going to go away. I mean, obviously, BioWare is too strong. They have...
Well, especially their core studios.
Right, Austin.
Austin. And there's Austin, and there's Edmonton, and there's Montreal as the kind of the three big ones.
Yeah, the brand is still very strong.
I mean, yeah, especially with Victory, just like slapping the BioWare name on that. I mean, there's been a lot of just slap the BioWare name on it.
So does it still warrant keeping it on there? I think they'll probably consider all of this stuff.
I think they will. I think the BioWare name is still really strong. And for the average gamer that plays Mass Effect 3 and enjoys it, they're not going to know that these doctors left. They don't care who Casey Hudson is. They don't care who the doctors are. They just want Mass Effect, and they want more of it.
So Ray's going on to do cool philanthropic work, and Greg is doing a beer video.
So excited about his beer videos. It's so awesome. Like, I hope I can retire and have a beer podcast when I'm done, because that would be fucking rad.
I just hope he has enough money to mass produce that beer, because I would totally
What did they
buy
sell BioWare for back in the day? $700 million?
No, I know.
I'm sure they're good.
I was being a little facetious.
Yeah. I do hope, both of them talked about having sort of ground down and lost the passion for it. And Ray said he's not coming back. Greg, though, left the door open, and I'm really hopeful that Greg will find renewed spirit to do video game work, because, I mean, come on, the games that they helped get to us, like Star Wars The Old Republic.
And that was great, man. Greg was hard on Star Wars The Old Republic. He was in Austin all the time. I mean,
so good.
Granted,
it was the best Star Wars property to come out, like,
yeah,
including those three crappy prequel movies.
If Greg can get that spark back, we will get more awesome, awesome games.
I think over the beer.
Do the beers.
They've had such an incredible career that, I don't think either of them will have any regrets leaving entirely,
No, there's no regrets.
They've had such a blasting impact,
So. Did you read Jeff Green's comment about them coming in and showing a Shattered Steel back in the day at CGW? It was amazing. It was like,
no, I didn't see that.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. Pretty crazy. Well, anyway, we wish them both most amazing best. And for everyone at BioWare, I hope you guys are ready to take the new challenges on. And for the fans, just, be patient. The next thing is the next thing. There's still a lot of creative folks there who are...
Well, they just announced the next Dragon Age
3.
Is Inquisition? Is that the right...
What a show.
And that's why I was worried about the backlash, because it's a Frostbite engine game, right?
Well, that's not necessarily
a bad thing. I mean, clearly EA is very invested in that engine.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, and then you look at how Dragon Age 1 was a game that it succeeded despite the way it looked, in my opinion.
Because they put so much work. I mean,
I thought that was a weird announcement, though. Like it was weird time. I don't know what the deal was with that. I mean, I guess they had there's been so many leaks about it that it just made sense to confirm it so they can finally say, yes, we're working on it. But really interesting timing. Like, I didn't really.
Yeah, just like random in the middle of the week, not even on a VGA,
Right. Yeah, it seemed odd. But like I said, maybe it was just because they're leaking. It's one of those things where I've had that too. We've had that in the past. Where it's man, this is leak. All the fans are talking about it. They all know there's stuff that's undeniable, and we just have to sit here and keep denying it. That's not really the best community thing.
I mean, they haven't even really denied it. They're like, yeah, we're making a new Dragon Age. We just haven't announced it yet. I mean, same thing with Mass Effect 3. We've called it a trilogy all this time, but we haven't actually announced Mass Effect 3 yet. Yeah.
We also learned that they're making a new Mass Effect game. They are earnestly in production on a new Mass Effect game. So I'm really curious whether it'll be pre or post Reaperpocalypse.
I'm curious to see if it's this generation or next, because
my question about Dragon Age.
I want franchises to stop. I just want them to stop right now and just wait for the next
time. We'll see with Mass Effect, though, because you're not going to go back on another Shepard adventure. That's it's like looking at any super Star Trek, Star Wars, any of those super huge, intricate universes and going, you know what? You could make anything out of this universe. Mm-hmm. You could pretty much do.
So would you want
Garrus size?
Would you want projected into the new Mass Effect world, or would you want old new Mass Effect world, or would you want to even go way back? They could go back to Precursor Legacy stuff.
I think it would be cool if they did a game where throughout most of it you're like, oh yeah, this is the Mass Effect universe, and then you're like, holy shit, this is actually the universe, a universe or two after the Reapers decimated, or some sort of tie-in. So
or we can do a time traveling Mass Effect and see all of them.
1.21 gigawatts,
88 miles an hour.
I just want Mass Effect 1.5 HD remix,
with only the cutscenes from the iPad game.
Duosidum. Of course, that'll be the way it goes. All right, One game that's getting a sequel this fall that is more predictable than not and has been described as evolutionary, not revolutionary, by their own designers, that's Halo 4. So I was a little worried after their most recent vid doc, because honestly, like, they're very gung-ho about it, very excited about it, and yet when, like, the creative team is all about, we're not doing anything amazing here, we're making Halo 4. I mean, that's paraphrasing. That's a kind of weird, it's kind of a weird take.
They showed that vid doc when I was visiting 343, and I was like,
it's a weird take.
I was like, what are you trying to tell me right now? And it's just like really bizarre. I think they really have to reassure fans that, like, hey, even though we're a new developer and we're doing completely new stuff, it's still Halo.
And the game looks ridiculous. Like, the part that's most amazing to me about them being like that is that, like you said, the game looks freaking ridiculous.
Yeah, the facial animation system in that game,
it's amazing.
Yeah. I mean,
what Ellie Noir, like, in that same ballpark.
I mean, I would never have expected that from...
So why do they sell them? Are they trying to do the whole deal of, like, well, we're going to set expectations low because then we're going to blow you away?
I think they are, actually, because, I mean... I went into Halo 4 very skeptical.
Really?
And what I played, that's probably my most wanted game right now. After
what?
Wow!
Megaton. I was just completely blown away because So they showed us two levels. The first level is the first level of the game, and you're just fighting grunts, and it's the same old shit, and it feels great. It's like, oh man, I haven't played like a Halo game in a while, and like, you just remember all the reasons why you love it, you know, just like the way the levels are open, just how the weapons work, the fact that you're not using iron sights, and like, you know, just the shields are back, and you're just it's like, wow, this is a classic Halo. And then it does the low grav thing, which they did, you know, a game or two ago, where it's like, oh man, this is awesome. And then they jumped us into the third level, and it's like, holy shit, this is a completely different game now, because you have the Forerunner, the Promethean technology, and you're fighting all these new enemies, and you're just like, man. And then at the end of the level, you're fighting grunts again, and you're just like, oh, that's boring. That's like, I don't Covenant weapons, like, I don't want this stuff. This is old. Like, because what they do with the new stuff is so amazing and so much fun and so fresh, and like relearning all these weapons. It's just like, oh man, it's just, I do think they're setting the expectations low, because there's a lot of new ideas in there. And
that's what I thought. I mean, I watched that vid doc and I was like, what?
I mean, the thing is, like, they get the Halo stuff right. It's a new development team, but like, they just get that out of the way. They're like, here, this is the Halo stuff that you know and love, and it feels great. And then like, I don't know how any person that hasn't played Halo is going to be able to get into Halo 4, because it's a really intimidating first level.
Oh, really?
Because, like, you are just... It's, like, dozens of enemies, just... And you're just constantly switching weapons. One thing that I noticed by Halo 4 is that there's very little ammo, so it, like, encourages you to just constantly, right, like, just empty your gun and then just, like, run over to a carcass and, like, pick up their weapon, and you're just, like, constantly switching things up. And, like, if you're not already familiar with how the needler works, if you're not already familiar with how the pistol works, like how are you going to survive, like, an onslaught of, you know, hundreds of enemies? And I'm just like, this is really intimidating. I mean, like, I got through it, but, like, I don't think a newcomer will be able to get through it, because there's no tutorial. There's no hand-holding. It's like...
Really?
It's like you're playing the last level of Reach, and, like, that's the beginning.
Did they not have I mean, to teach you your controls, like, wake the chief up sort of thing they always do, like, look up, look down.
There is a brief look up, look down thing when a Master Chief, like, exits his cryostasis, and then it's just, like, insanity.
But that's more
that.
Like, to, like, do you like to aim inverted or not?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
You know.
But after that, like, there's no hand-holding in terms of, like, you know...
Here's traditional Halo tactics.
Two points about what you just said. One is, now I'm, like, ridiculously excited for it. But number two, back to what Garnett was saying... I think that the reason that a lot of these big, huge franchises don't, you know, or downplay or really don't iterate as or get as inventive as they should is because they're really like, you know, after you have a few games out, you become like a sports franchise, right? Mm-hmm. It's a competitive sport. You don't want to, like, all of a sudden play a game of football where, like, the goalposts are on the, you know, the east and west
XFL.
Sides of the field or whatever. You know, you don't want to totally reinvent the game. So it's like, you've got to deliver, you know, an improved version of what people come to expect. But that sounds really, really cool.
I mean, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Halo 4 is the Metroid game that Nintendo's never going to make ever again. So, like, might as well go for it. It looks like Metroid. No. In many ways, it feels like Metroid because the maps are so big. And it's gorgeous. Like, I really cannot emphasize how much better it looks than Reach.
And it's even a combination of, like, the art design looks awesome. Yeah, the tech is awesome.
What they did was, like, I think they just rehauled the lighting system, and there's just some, like, really interesting stuff that they're doing. And like I said, the facial animation stuff is incredible. I mean,
and that comes from a franchise where the facial animation was shit. There was some bad, like, Halo 2, some of the stuff in there, like, that was never a
where
game
Sarge
really
is
known.
Talking to you.
Right. You're like, just like, wow, like that is a big difference from old Halo, where, like, facial animation never really seemed like it was a mm-hmm. huge priority in those games, versus now it's like, I mean, it's a very expensive, very time consuming thing, but they obviously put a ton of effort into it.
There's a new villain that they're gonna introduce in Halo 4, which I'm not allowed to talk about, but, like, I saw it and it's like, wow. Like, just wow, and just seeing the way, like, he emotes, it's like, I got really into it. I'm
getting,
like,
excited again. So how cool was Cortana?
One of the first things
I'm not saying that she's a villain, I'm saying how cool was Cortana.
Yeah, the first things you see is Cortana, and, like, just the facial animation system, like, completely blew me. I'm like, is this the same game? Like, and the fact that she can emote now, just visually, and you know, you mm-hmm. hear the voice acting, it just really adds a lot of impact.
Are they playing up the whole, like, I mean, one of the things that they were talking about originally was, like, you know, she was only supposed to last X number of years, but
if you read the novels, yeah, like, she's totally, the whole rampancy issue for her is definitely picking up. So
she's going wacko.
And I think even if from the vid docs I've seen, like, you've seen a couple sequences where it looks like she's freaking out, and mm-hmm. so it definitely feels like the rampancy is going to be a big story point over, I don't know if it's just this game or this whole trilogy of game. Have they called it a trilogy?
Yeah, it's a trilogy. Yeah.
So the second trilogy is definitely going to, I think, try to figure out how this AI adapts.
It feels definitely a lot more personal and a lot more human than the previous Halo games. Master Chief's a lot more talkative. Just, you know, there's a lot of dialogue throughout the missions between him and Cortana.
It feels like, especially with Frankie running kind of the creative vision in a lot of ways, like, he was someone who's always very concerned about the story, very concerned about the fiction, very concerned about the universe. And now, you know, that is a driving force within the entire studio there as a whole to ensure that is a major part of the experience. And a lot of times I think people would look at a Halo game as multiplayer with sort of a campaign to train you on the side, where now I really feel like that campaign is huge. You're still going to have giant multiplayer. And then on top of that, they have the whole Spartan Ops thing, which is also story driven and is going to have all these, like, episodes mm-hmm. of, you know, content and footage you watch then play. Like, it's a big, big package.
It is an incredible value.
Best Halo ever?
I'm like already ready to say that, but, like, obviously we have to hold our reservation. But I'm more excited for Halo 4 than I've been for any previous Halo
game.
What is
it? This is September 21st. The game's out November 6th. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're done, right? Like, to get this thing.
Actually, it's coming in really hot.
But even then, like, if they're going to produce the number of copies of Halo you got to ship, like, they got to be close, like, mm-hmm. within the next week or two. I think they're gold if they aren't already. So, I mean, like, it's crazy to think about, but Halo 4 is, if it's
done.
Not done, it's close to
it's
done.
Done.
It's going into the can, and in a month and a half we play it.
And we have to remember that the original Halo wasn't designed as a trilogy. They didn't have that in mind. You know, it sort of happened after the fact, after how successful Halo 1 was.
Hence the little shop of horrors.
But, you know, Halo 4, they're going into it knowing full well that it's a trilogy. And I think you actually, you sort of feel that in the way the pacing feels in the story. The universe has gotten so much bigger. I mean, they have, you know, Ford Unto Dawn, they have the, you know, they have the movie, they have Spartan Ops. They're going all out with this, like, transmedia universe that they're building.
I think one of the things that's cool from a fiction standpoint that they do is you faced the Covenant for so long, and the Covenant was this huge alien conglomerate of brutes and elites and grunts and the religion, and you constantly were having this thought of, like, how the hell can humanity ever survive against them? And not only do you survive, but now in Halo 4 it turns around and says, yeah, the Covenant, they ain't shit.
Yeah, and I have to say the Prometheans are a lot harder to fight than even, because the basic enemy is actually stronger than an elite.
Yeah, like, the basic knight starts off more badass than
and,
elite,
and just the tactics you have to employ it's just so much fun, especially when you have like elites fighting those knights, and you're in the middle of that. So there's, like, this weird, like, race versus race, and you're like cross in the middle, and you're
kind
just
of
trying
almost like Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah, and you're just trying to run through it. Some sections is just better just to run and hope they don't see you, just because there's like so much happening.
Sneak through the fight. That's pretty sweet.
And it's great when you when you're like mixing up weapons. You know, like you get your Covenant weapons, and you're fighting against, you know, the Prometheans, and the Promethean weapons are so sweet though. Like, you know, if enemies don't disintegrate in Halo, it's like that's so like lackluster now. Like that effect is just,
I want to disintegrate all the enemies.
Yeah, essentially, I hate picking up weapons that aren't Promethean weapons, because I'm like, enemies should disintegrate, and like, I hate killing things that aren't Prometheans, because Prometheans, they all die.
It's
like,
kind of crazy. Did you watch all that vid doc? They even show that the disintegration animation
happens. Yeah, starts
wherever you shoot them. So yeah. If you shoot them in the shoulder, they disintegrate from there. If you shoot them in the knee, they disintegrate. Like, it's ridiculous.
The
graphical fidelity is ridiculous.
Just fighting them is just so fun. It's just like, I mean, it is Halo, but it is new. I mean, one thing I don't think they've shown off yet is there's this like first person Uncharted sequence when like everything is Metroid in this game. Everything explodes and you're always running away. you know, you're on your ship and it's obviously exploding.
It's exploding, of course.
And so you have to get out in time. And like, there's this great sequence where you're like climbing up this like elevator shaft in first person and like dodging debris as it's coming down. And like, you've never seen this in a Halo game.
That's
before.
Definitely not a Halo game.
And it feels great. Like, I don't know how they did it. It must have been like really subtle stuff, but I didn't like, I was just like moving left and right and just like going. I had no idea what I was doing, but it felt really natural. And I knew I was controlling the character. It's not like, you know, it's not like scripted and on rails, you know?
There weren't giant prompts on the screen.
No,
like,
there was
ding, 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 ding.
The HUD didn't say, press right trigger now, you know? Like, you
it
know,
was like
it's
a quick time
a
event without being a quick time event.
Yeah, almost. And I really don't know how they pulled that off, but it was really immersive. And you really, I mean, I love the Metroid escape the exploding planet thing. And the fact that they seem to do it in every level, I'm okay with that.
I would say, too, as a big fan of Halo, if you are excited, the books, they have a couple books. There's Karen Travis, who wrote a bunch of Star Wars and a bunch of other novels. She's pretty well known. She did one book earlier this year, Glasslands, I believe. And there's another one coming out, I think, in a couple weeks. And when I was reading Glasslands, it definitely felt like it was leading into, and I think more things we've seen from Halo 4 show that these two novels are the lead-in to Halo 4. So if you're a big Halo geek, or even someone who just likes Halo and is looking for something to read, I think it'd be
probably worth
checking out. Yeah, they're probably some of the best Halo novels written, in my opinion, too, because they have one of the best authors they've had working on that. Greg Bear is also doing like a whale prequel, and he's a great author too. But yeah, some good stuff too.
Okay, I am certainly guilty of getting drawn in by perceptions. And this is going to be, by the way, James, this is my lead to let you talk about Fuse.
Okay.
My lead to let you talk about Fuse, because I actually, like, I realized that what you guys showed originally about Overstrike was that sort of sizzle reel sort of deal where it's like, here's a flavor, here's some ideas we're playing with, here's, you know, some things we want you to get, you know, like, your head around and see what you think of. But I really liked it. I thought there was this very cool sense to the Overstrike original trailer of something that kind of combined a drifting towards a no one lives forever sort of vibe with a little fun, little tongue in cheek, drifting towards a little bit of Team Fortress with a, you know, stylized but not completely cartoonified sort of look to it, and yet still plenty of team cooperative play elements, and just like a really cool atmospheric vibe around it. Flash forward to now, and all I've seen of Fuse, obviously I wasn't there, which I will take my lumps for, but all I've seen of Fuse is the video. And yeah, you know what? Insomniac, obviously, from Resistance 1, 2, and 3, knows how to make a badass, wicked 3D engine and do really great, realistic-looking, you know, settings and all of those pieces of furnishing and character art and all those things that go in there. But it just didn't, like, I didn't get the same, you know, I just didn't get the same thing off of it. So hit me with the Fuse.
Well, I mean, if you haven't seen the Fuse trailer, it's youtube.com/FuseGame. And I think, you know, we've been working on Fuse for a long time since it was Overstrike. And we felt we had to change somewhat from where we were because it wasn't totally clicking. And we really had to kind of take the chains off ourselves and let ourselves go really loose. You saw some of the weapons. Like, the game was fun, but it wasn't quite there. Like, there was something missing. And we didn't really know how to capture it. And we really started taking the constraints off the weapons and going really just over the top, getting back to what we do with weapons. And
I don't think anyone argue that's what Insomniac does best.
It was one of those snowball effects where things really started to go. I do think some people got the impression from that original Overstrike trailer that the game was, you know, it looked like The Incredibles or it looked incredibly stylized. I felt like that was like you were seeing one part of it, but you weren't seeing how it was also semi-realistic in that trailer or semi-real looking. Like it never was that stylized to be like a total CG movie sort of look. It never had that look. It didn't look like that at the time. And I think really where we're at, it's not a realistic game. It's not a military shooter. This is still, there's some really over the top crazy stuff that happens in this game. There's still some really good humor. The characters are actually relatively similar. They maybe don't have quite the same style they had in that trailer, but I think some of that's actually coming back now. And, you know, you'll see them in different outfits throughout the course of the game too. But I really think what we had to do was unleash ourselves on that weapon side to help make the combat really feel satisfying. And we've really, the co-op of the game is really strong. It's a 4-player co-op shooter. Each character has their own special weapon that kind of gives them a class and certain abilities. There's also a full progression tree for each character and different branches of the progression tree. So as you keep playing, you level up, and it's a co-op game that I think has come a long way. And maybe the style wasn't, I think, you know, you set people up for that style, and I'm sure there's some folks who were disappointed by it. But I really think as a cohesive whole, everything drives together better now, and the game is better for it.
I can buy that.
And, you know, it maybe isn't popular because people wanted that. And that's, you know, we're going to do our best to prove it. We're going to do our best to get people.
I think what it is for me is that I wanted what my imagination created as a mental game out of the trailer.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it does, because I think that's the hardest part for us right now is seeing, you know, we knew what the game was when we put that trailer out, and I think some people took the trailer differently than what we were even making.
So tell me what it's like. I mean, because it's easy to, like, I'm sure it's a very elusive thing to try to describe, but what is it like in a creative capacity to have, like, this thing, and you're working on it, and you feel like you've got a spark at something that's working, but then, like, what is it about it that feels like it's not working? Like, and maybe not even, you don't have to be applied specifically to Fuse, because I don't want you to, like, create quotes that people come back and throw at your face. But yeah. I'm like, what is that? Can you describe some of what that's like so we know what was the motivation to move forward with going different ways?
Well, so you feel something. You see flashes of fun. You see, like, I mean, I don't know. It's sort of almost in a way.
I'm sorry, I just love the term flashes of fun.
Flashes of fun?
Yeah, I don't know. That's really hard because it's so subjective.
Right.
But you kind of know it too, I think, when you're doing it. If you aren't sitting there constantly when you're playing something like that, like, okay, this feels amazing, like it feels awesome, when you're like, this can, if you know it can still get better, and sometimes you have good art and you've designed it and you've played it a bunch and something's missing, you know? Mm-hmm. It's almost like that intangible thing. You're like, this isn't quite there, and it could be, you know, it could be something in Resistance where, you know, we would say, you know, this isn't quite right. Or even in Ratchet, there's times where, like, this level, something's missing about this level. It doesn't feel alive. Like, what is it? And we'd have to go back to the drawing board a little bit. And, you know, you start, in some ways, you go back to the very beginning and you just kind of challenge every single assumption. But it's really one of those weird things where it's like, we know what a good game is, but it's so hard to define what that is. Because you can have something that has amazing art and, you know, interesting enemies and fun weapons, and it's not coming together for some reason. And it, you know, it's like I said, it's a feeling. And I really don't know if there's a way to fully describe that. And I think it's different for every situation. But for whatever reason, that semi-realistic look and those, you know, those moments weren't quite gelling the way we wanted. We needed to take kind of that step back and really push ourselves to make those weapons feel even more satisfying. Because, like, you saw the weapons where they kind of were in that Overstrike trailer, and, you know, they weren't as satisfying. I mean, they're clearly not as satisfying as they are now. They're fucking awesome now.
So reflective of you guys designing by playing a whole lot.
We play all the time. I mean,
every designer says that, but it sounds like in this case, this is clearly a matter of we're playing the game. It's not where we want it. Why are we trying to shove this thing down the hall? Let's figure out, like, make it work.
Yeah, and I mean, and I don't know if it was exactly like that, but I mean, like, if you come to our office and you hang out in that Fuse area, right in the middle there, in the middle of everyone, there are four stations set up for everyone to sit down and just play. Hmm. And so, like, people will be playtesting something and a crowd will gather around to watch it and be interacting and discussing it.
That's cool.
So you can see four people. You can see what they're all doing right there in front of you. And you can all talk about it as a group. And I think that's really powerful to have that four-player moment and discuss that as a group together all the time and really work on that. And I think really just driving the design more and, you know, really kind of finding our legs on how we wanted to make this an awesome co-op shooter, because, you know, like, you go way back and Brian Elgar said, you know, like, at one point we were thinking about it being more of a stealth game rather than a shooter. And, like, really, like, as we kind of got to that point where this is what the fun is, and figuring out Fuse is the core of that game and Fuse is the core of the weapons, and then driving that out into everything, once we kind of captured and all centered on that one thing together as a group, that's when, you know, shit snowballs. And Insomniac's been really good at that over the years, of having that core idea and putting games together. You know, as soon as things start coming together, like, our stuff is it's unbelievable how quickly things change and how amazing things come together.
As we can notice, since you're out in March.
In March, yeah.
Jesus. It's like almost here, dude.
Yeah, I know. Like, it's coming up fast. So, we're crushing it right now, and we're working really hard, and the team's working really hard, but I think the game is showing really well for it. And, you know, I was talking to Ted just yesterday, and it's like everyone's been playing through the full game right now, because, you know, you can play through it, and there's certainly parts that need work, but there's some really, really fun co-op shooter stuff.
I just like to note that Weekend Confirmed is usually a four-player show.
All right, we can four-player it. I call Izzy. I like to heal.
All right, you'll be the Izzy. All right, so we're going to take one more break. When we come back on the other side, I still want to talk some FTL, and we will have like a little off-mic communication session to figure out what else we want to cram into this last section. So don't go anywhere. We will be right back on the other side. Dave, that one sounded a little crushed, man. I think you need to, like, back down some of the compression or something on there. It sounded a little, don't you think? So what do you think, Micah? It sounded a little crushed, don't you think? Yeah, it does have a good feel. I agree. It has a good feel. It's just like, I don't know, there's something a little crushed about it sonically to me. I don't know. Yeah. All right, well, there you go. So I'm wrong. Micah likes it because it's crushed. Anyway, jumping back right into the thing. What is Dave shooting me arrows?
He's ignoring you. That's what's funny about it.
Like, whatever.
Whatever.
Like, I don't even care. Let's talk about FTL. So FTL is this.
God, it's so good. For the lose?
For
the loss.
Or Faster Than Light. This incredible indie game that is done by these two guys in China.
It was a Kickstarter.
Well, they kickstarted it to finish it.
Right.
And they asked for like 10,000 and got 200 and something, wasn't it?
Was it that much? I thought it was like, maybe it was 190 or it was 90. I know. I feel like 90.
They got like a ridiculous amount of money on their Kickstarter.
They did really well.
And so let me describe it. It's first of all, it's $9. It's $9. You can buy it directly off of ftlgame.com.
And that's redeemable on Steam, too.
And they give you a Steam code as well. And you can use – one of the things I think is really cool is it's actually done by – they're using a Humble Bundle as their checkout, which means you can use like Amazon checkout or Google Pay or PayPal. It's really easy to get. So the game has been often described as a roguelike, and I think that's a tad misleading, because a roguelike, if you played a rogue, is a randomly generated series of dungeons where you're walking your character through and there's a bunch of random stuff that drops and you're, you know, hitting griffins and wyverns and all that kind of stuff and waiting to see what happens and see how far you can go before you die. Now, the how far you can go before you die part applies here for sure.
And permadeath is a big thing too for rogues. So yeah. if you die in this game, you're starting from the beginning again.
But that's the cool part is every time you start a ship, it's a new story. It's a new adventure to see.
But
what
I
happens.
Want one of my stories to end happily, and they haven't yet. And I'm playing on easy.
Oh, dude. Well, that's it. I'm playing on normal. This is why we're in different.
Jesus Christ.
Dude, normal is batshit insane.
Dude, easy's hard. Like, really? Easy, this is the hardest game I've played on easy in some time. Like,
all right, let me finish the description. So, back in the day, there was this board game called Starfleet Battles, and it was Star Trek licensed, and you had a piece of graph paper that looked like you had a starship with graph paper pieces on the inside, and the graph paper pieces on the inside were boxes that showed you each of the systems for the ship. And this game, part of it is built around that. So you have a ship on the screen, and that is the dungeon piece. And then you have characters who are your crew members within there, and you can assign them and move them around throughout the spaceship to man different stations, like your sensors, your engines, your weapon systems, your helm, and your shields. And when they're there, they make those things work better. They are your damage control team. So when things catch on fire or whatever, you can send them in to go fight the fire. Or they also are your border repelling team, your security forces. So when you get boarded, you know, they're in there fighting it like with little laser beams or whatever, and they like lose points.
And they even fist fight and stuff to you.
You're also at the same time being the captain and controlling all of the things that you imagine, you know, the like Adama controlling on the bridge of Battlestar Galactica. It's like you're transferring power to different systems. You're deciding which weapons to bring online, what to target on your enemies. And that's the two roles you take in the game. So at one point you're and the screen display shows the ship, and then around the edges are these interface pieces that allow you to do like the energy management and that sort of thing. The simplicity of it is that there's nothing that really happens that's grandly animated or anything. Like, there is a star map, and each time you jump a planet forward, one thing happens. And in this regard, it's very much like an adventure game.
Yeah,
you get to a planet. And something happens. You might run into... It might just be a combat. It might be there's another ship there. You're going to have to fight them. Fight happens. Boom, boom, boom. But sometimes it's more of a choose your own adventure sort of thing.
And depending on what you have, too, sometimes you have better options unlocked because there's different races for the crew members. So there's like a big rock-type alien that can put out fires really well. So if you get to a space station that's on fire, you have a blue option where you can send him.
The blue
option is always good. So you can send him and he'll go put the fire out with no damage and make sure that like you don't lose anything. You know you're going to end up... And where sometimes you'll find these choose your own adventure options, you choose the wrong thing, it'll kill half your crew in one fell swoop.
And the progression of the game is that you start off being chased by a fleet of rebels who are out to stop you from getting wherever you are.
You have the Death Star plans, basically.
You have the Death Star plans.
Oh, and you're playing as the man in this one. So if the rebels are after you.
Evidently, because the rebels are after you. It is interesting the rebel fleet is after you, but you've got their invasion plans or whatever, and you're running.
Nice.
And so each sector of the world that you're in is comprised of a number of planets, and you have to move across the planets fast enough. If the fleet, like the little line that shows you the fleet on the sector map, gets to you, that's it. That's like that.
You run into some powerful ships.
I've had that happen a couple times, and it was over so fast I don't even know what happened. I was like, what just hit me?
Right. And then as you finish a sector, then it shows you a sector map where you kind of have to pick, you know, it's almost Star Fox style where it's like you can kind of see branching path the next sector. Do you want to go to the hostile sector? Do you want to go to the nebula where it's cloudy and your sensors won't work? Or do you want to go to like a more friendly sector? And like those decisions affect what your next planet layout is going to look like.
So now that we've laid this thing out for you, you can have your head around it. The thing that is amazing about this game is that every time you start a ship and play it, it's like playing a season of your favorite sci-fi show. And each planet is an episode. It's like you go to these planets and something happens. And the most fantastic part of this game is as things start to go wrong, it gets increasingly more fun. So it's like, oh, shit. Yes.
Until you hit the cliff.
Yeah.
Like there is a fun level and then like, oh, we're fucked and you're dead and you start the game over.
Yeah, it's like how many things can you manage as things go wrong?
So it's like Star Trek if they blew up every episode.
Right, it's like Star Trek if they didn't always survive. Right. Like there are times.
The end of the season is your ship explodes.
You know what this sounds like to me? It sounds like Oregon Trail in space. In some ways there's if Oregon Trail was brutally challenging with an action component, because like when you actually are fighting these ships, it's like, you know, you have to manage, oh, I'm firing my weapons. What systems am I targeting on that ship? I want to take their shields out so that I can damage their weapons or their engine. And, oh, they're trying to escape now. We got to stop them. You're dealing with that. Then you're also dealing with what's going on your ship. I'm dealing with my power levels. Oh, my shields just got hit. Oh, shit, there's a fire in my engine bay. And if we have to put that out, you actually can control all the doors on your ship as long as your door control is operational and just open
the
doors.
God forbid you open the damn doors and then lose your door control.
Right. Because
I've had that happen.
Right. Like, and that's crazy. Like, you'll open the doors to flood, to take out a fire because you can just vent your atmosphere. And then suddenly your door controls go out and you can't get anywhere and you can't stop your atmosphere from venting, or your oxygen gets taken out and now you can't replenish the oxygen on your ship and your oxygen's behind the whole area that was
had
on
this
fire.
Happened before.
And so you're like, shit, I have to, if I send guys through, they're gonna like slowly die on their way to the oxygen thing. It's
had this happen
brutal.
Had this exact same thing happen on a solar flare planet
where it randomly causes fucking fires on your ship, and
yes,
fires suck the oxygen out of the room,
yes,
on their own, but you also have to do that. They're really hard to beat out.
So I finally got the doors back online, but now like everything, so, and the ship's all compartmentalized, right? And so I finally got the doors back online, so I'm able to close stuff off to where I can get back to the oxygen. And so now I'm like running dudes out of sick bay, because there's a sick bay where as long as the guy's in the sick bay, they like heal back up.
As long as it's not damaged.
Right. So I'm running dudes from sick bay back to the back of the ship where the O2 thing is and getting a little work done on the O2 and then running them back. But the problem is every time they leave, then that repair starts to fall off.
Right.
So it's like I'm having to figure out, okay, I'm going to have these guys. Okay, this guy, you run down there and pick up the repair. Okay, now you run back out. Now you run back down here.
And are you dealing with a fight at this point? Is there another ship still firing?
No, I finished
you
the fight.
That off.
But every couple of minutes, another flare is going off and another damn fire is starting.
Ship.
Like, oh my God, I'm never going to get out of here. And of course, I got out of there. And the very, very next jump, I got hammered by pirates.
Right.
Just like totally hammered by. They boarded.
And that's the worst part is when guys board your ship, like it's fucking brutal. Like,
oh, it's
some,
brutal.
And there's
they
like some where it's like, oh,
so
there's
fast.
Four. And the one interesting thing is I actually had a really good crew that made it to like the second to last sector before they got killed. And I ran into some really hard shit. And I actually had at that point, you can get hull breaches. Have you seen those yet? Where someone hits you and you get a breach in a sector of your ship that causes just that sector to lose air.
Oh, yeah. We got like the
Yeah. I hadn't seen those until just this last play. But you get to this point where, like, you got your guys do level up. So, like, they level their – if you have a guy who just focuses on driving the ship, he gets better and better.
Yep.
And also, if you deal with some fights, like, you want some guys to board you because you need to level up their fighting ability in order to be able to deal with
You can beam them over and you can –
You can build a beaming. The first ship in the game doesn't come equipped with a beamer or a drone thing, but other ships you can unlock to try and play the game with do have those. So right off the bat, you can beam your own crew over and try and take it out that way. But you have to level those things up, and you also have to level your ship. So you can increase you can increase your reactor, you can increase your weapon systems, and how you so you can increase the amount of power you have. You can increase the amount of power that goes to each system. You can build
blast doors. At first, I didn't think blast doors were important, but now I realize I want blast doors early.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, fire spreads so fast if you don't have blast doors. So once you install blast doors, then of course, now, because what happens like originally is you get hit and you're like, oh, I've got a fire in my engine room, no big deal. Well, what you don't realize if you haven't upgraded your doors, that fire starts to spread really fast.
Well, the problem is.
And then you've got a big problem.
The secondary issue is you have to decide what's most important. If you start upgrading your blast doors, well, later on, and especially when things ramp up towards the end, like. Now you maybe aren't as well equipped to deal with something else. So
yep.
You're always constantly like, do I want to have my engines up so that I can beam away from a system really fast and escape back to a safe area? Do I want to have good weapons and shields so that I can do combat well? But maybe if I catch fire, like I had a ship that was like, I can go places fast, I can blow up other ships fast. And I thought I was prepared for a boarding party, and then this boarding party ripped me the fuck up, lit my shit on fire, and by the end, my sensors are gone, I have no idea what's going on in my ship, half my crew's dead, my ship's burning down, my shields are gone.
You feel so bad when the crew dies, too. You're like,
oh, I feel horrific about it. And you can buy more crew members and stuff, but everything, like, there's no point in this game, because of the way the enemy forces come in, and you're forced out of the sectors, it is actually important to stay in a sector as long as you can,
right.
To do as many things, because you need to get scrap.
You're like watching
currency.
You're watching the fleet creep across from the left to right, and you're
right.
Like, okay, how many more planets can I get in before they get here?
You want to explore as much as possible early while it's still easy, but at the same token, like, you must make these decisions and you must put yourself in the right place, because
it gets so hard at the end. It's almost a little bit of luck too, because if you run into the wrong thing or you make the wrong decision on a choose your own adventure moment, like, you lose a crew member. That guy was vital. He had this role. My shields aren't as effective now. There's a boarding party, or that was my combat guy. That was my fire guy.
That's like, what happened. Like, you put him in a red shirt.
The only question I have is, how fast can I get home and hit the fucking buy button get this thing?
Yeah, no, it sounds like what I wanted Battlestar Galactica to be.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's definitely, if you like that, and it's crazy addictive. It's so addictive.
And even the fact that you lose a whole ship, and yeah, it sucks to lose, but a game is what, 20, 30 minutes?
Depends on how far you get. I mean,
I think maybe, but so I feel like even if you get to the end.
Highly recommend when you play on normal that you pause, space bar to pause.
And set your decisions up. Yeah. I do that on easy as is.
You definitely don't want to do that. There's like, what else is there? In addition to figuring out how you want to upgrade, sometimes you get quests from some of your planets. Depending on, so if you have like the right person to initiate the right option, you may also get then like an option that says like, can you help us get to this outpost, or can you go investigate what's happening over here?
I haven't even gotten any of that yet.
You get some missions like where you'll hit a planet and they'll like talk to you and say, oh, there, and then you'll have a marker, and you know how sometimes you have markers for like for distress calls or whatever. So then another one will say quest, and then that'll be like a quest location.
That's cool. I haven't gotten any of those yet. That's awesome.
It's FTL. FTL game.
For $9, it's one of the better PC distraction fun games.
Do you know if it's available for Mac?
I don't.
I think it is. I think, as a matter of fact, if I remember reading their site correctly, they may even have a Linux port.
Not to be confused with FML. Don't buy that game, kids. That's a bad game.
All right, so that's FTL. Wow. It really is. I think the part that stands out to me the most is that if you read around, also, I didn't really like. I love the fact
it looks
that,
like, it's on Mac, by the way. Just
it is, so,
yeah. It's
what,
on Mac,
what hooked so. Me on it was reading people talking about it and telling stories of their adventures, and I can like we were just doing. I have the exact same thing now. It's amazing. It's like you feel like, and that's the really cool part is that each of the planets really feels like the episode, and each time you fire up a ship is the season.
Well, and it's
two.
it's so abstract, like everything, the characters, you know, they have a name and they're a little person, but you can't, everything's so abstracted that you really do feel like you're imagining it. It allows your imagination to fill in all
it is
those
a good
blanks.
Reminder of how important that is, right?
Yep.
How important really, it is, like, you don't have to spell everything out for people.
No, you can let people bring that up on their own and have that in their brain, and it works really, really well.
It sounds like like a board game, almost like a classic RPG.
That
whole
it.
Top-down aspect and just the small pieces, it really does have a live board game, fast board game feel where, you know, obviously it's more real-time than a board game, but it definitely has that feel to it where, you know, you're playing with a very abstract set piece.
Definitely.
Set of pieces. That's what I was trying to say.
Well, if you ever imagined what Half-Life would look like were it to be completely redone, that is what Black Mesa is all about. Jeff's been playing that.
Yeah, I have. I won't go into too much detail because
People don't know what the game is about?
Well, no. I'm only a couple hours, 2.5 hours in.
Look, what we really want to know is how badass does it look?
It is badass. And like, you know, whenever these mods come out and people have really ambitious projects and you check them out and usually they're okay. This is really good.
How does it compare to Half-Life 2?
Well, it's I think using the 2007 version of the Source SDK. Mm-hmm. So, it's on par with Half-Life 2. I mean, that's the, you know, the character animations, everything's a lot more, the color palette seems better. Basically everything. It looks like it was basically built the same time that Half-Life 2 was built. And it's sort of one of those everything old is new again, because I cannot remember the last time I played the original Half-Life, but I have very, very strong, like, resonating fond memories about certain specific sections of that game. This hits all the notes that it needs to hit, but it changes up just enough that you don't feel like, oh, wow, they're really taking liberties with this, but it's like little subtle things like, you know, the dude that, so in the beginning, before you even get your first gun, you're walking through, you're about to get your your suit, and there's a guy, a scientist in the locker room, and he's like, why do they make us wear these ridiculous ties? And you keep interacting with him, and they've added like, and these pleated pants are terrible, and these loafers are horrible, and it's, what is this, a fashion, or we should have a fashion consultant on staff. And it's like, but you know, it's not hitting you over the head with it. It's like these little things, these little Easter eggs that if you're very familiar with the first game, you'll definitely appreciate them. And plus the fact that it just looks ridiculously good. It's like if you
– The side-by-sides look amazing.
Yeah, yeah. It's just it is as good as those would seem to indicate just in terms of a visual upgrade. some of the layouts are different. Some of the puzzles that I've encountered are slightly different. I felt like I got my pistol, for example, my first pistol – a bit later than I did in,
yeah,
in the original game.
Yeah, I think and zombies appear before the headcrabs and
yeah, there's little things and there's, you know, they've redone all the audio, but it's so well done that you even when you're listening to the tram narrator at first or you get to the first Barney that you run into, you're like, "Oh, that's really cool. They really cleaned up the audio." And then he starts saying stuff that's not in the original, and you're like, "Wow, that's a really good."
I heard
like,
that they
facsimile of somebody basically imitated. All
I heard that
voice
they
work.
Tweaked it so that it fits better into Half-Life 2. Like
I have
that the two stories meld a bit better.
I would believe that. Hmm. I haven't. I'm not yet far enough in to really say that one way or the other.
Do you think they use the original dialogue, or do they just re-record the original dialogue with the new person that way?
It's a bit of both. They use the original dialogue, and then they actually had a writer come on who sort of enhanced stuff but was trying to be very
– I just meant from an actor perspective. Did they actually use that from the original game or did they re-record it entirely?
Oh, they re-recorded the whole thing.
Okay, got it. Yeah, so it wasn't like they just tried to imitate the original actor. They redid all the lines. So that's why it sounds like the same person.
But the guy does sound like – yeah, exactly.
Right, but it does sound like the old game. Just, yeah. But it's all fully updated.
Yeah, and it's you know, a little bit more robust. Like it's not just these one little sound bites. Right. It's – you know, there's more conversations going on. You know, the very beginning of the game is still like, I had like almost felt like a half an hour, 40 minutes of just taking the tram ride down and going down and getting your suit and doing all that stuff. And it's just, it's very, very nostalgic. And at the same time, it's like, it's a really great thing because people that haven't played Half-Life, the original Half-Life, and wouldn't necessarily go back because it is a really old game now, should by all means go back and check this out, especially if you played Half-Life 2 and liked it. There's no reason not to play Black Mesa if you can, you know, do the 3.5 gig download. And
so you can pick it up from their website, right?
Yes.
What's the installation process?
Well, for me, and I got it from File Shack before we pulled that down, but it was basically a one-shot 3.5 gig download.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it broken down into three sections, and that's a little bit more work to get all the parts compiled and installed. But basically, when you install it, when I installed it, it automatically, you know, pulled the 2007 source SDK, installed that, and now it's running in Steam. I mean, there's basically a little Steam icon, so it just totally integrated itself right into Steam.
Nice. It's the on Greenlight, right?
Like
it's
So vote that up because it's really
get
good.
An official release.
Yeah,
yeah. I think it's already approved. It just has to do whatever.
Okay, well, if it's
but
already
sadly that means they're going to.
Oh yeah, you're right. It was one of the 10.
That means they're going to add Zine to it, doesn't it?
They did. They have not added it yet, apparently. Right. But the reason that they didn't is because of your like how you're reacting. Everybody kind of reacts to the Zen stuff at the end or whatever, however you pronounce it.
It was really bad.
Yeah, because you're just like, awful. Oh, this game is awesome. And then like, what is this?
It's like a weird epilogue that was like completely unnecessary.
And don't you fight like a giant fetus or something in the end? Or like, well,
yeah, that's one game that didn't.
Yeah,
need a
sorry,
boss
everyone
fight.
That hadn't played Half-Life and we just convinced to play Half-Life because we spoiled your ass.
Oh, well.
No. You know what? Half-Life is one of those games where the journey is what it's all about. It is such a great journey game.
Yeah. It's not going to ruin the
trip. It's totally a great journey game.
But the giant fetus.
Yeah. Ugh. Well, hopefully. Well, okay. But that's not in Black Mesa right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not in Black Mesa right now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing that.
Play it now.
I almost made
play
a political joke.
It's amazing that fans have made the HD remake that they've always wanted Valve to make.
Yeah.
I think, you know what? Let's just get the Black Mesa guys to make Half-Life 3.
Yeah, and hopefully
it might be finished soon.
At this point, I would not be surprised to hear that Valve was talking to working with these guys in a more official capacity.
I mean, yeah,
long term,
I mean,
they did really good work on this.
I mean, Valve is definitely one of those companies that actively recruits people from the modding community. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at Counter Strike, look at
Dota,
Portal. Portal, there we go. Yeah,
yeah. But yeah, definitely check it out. Make sure you blow up the souffle in the kitchen. the first time you play it, and talk to the dude in there because he's got probably 20 things to say. It's great.
All right, everybody, crank it up because you know what it is? Now we're at the end of the show, which means it's time for finishing moves.
It's the weekend, and it's time for finishing moves.
Yeah. Okay, Andrew Yoon, you may kick us off. Finish them.
I recently got the PlayStation wireless stereo headset.
Oh, I saw that thing you were wearing.
Yeah, yeah. It's we got it on Monday, so I'm like, Happy Rosh Hashanah, everyone. You know, it was great. I've been wanting this for a long time, and now that I actually had some time to use it, I'm really happy with it.
Yeah, it's 7.1 sound.
I mean, so the surround sound, it has its highs and lows. I think it definitely seems to work better with like action movies and video games than it does, you know, say like a comedy, for example, because the bass is like a bit too strong. So like, you know, it works great when there's like lots of explosions, but you know, the higher pitch treble, like, it sort of gets muted. You know, I don't think the balance is quite there. I forget what I was watching. I think it was maybe Archer, where mm-hmm. it's like I had trouble hearing the dialogue.
Well,
like,
that's a bummer.
Like, the mixing wasn't entirely there.
So whatever's down mix wasn't working quite right. Or...
Yeah, but, you know, it's still really comfortable. You know, I'm wearing glasses and, like, it still fits with my ears really well. And the thing that really sells me with it is that the setup is so easy because I've used other, you know, surround sound headsets that connect to consoles, and it's just really a hassle because you have to, like, get the AV splitter and you have to, like, feed it into the box, and then, like, there's all these wires, and, like, it's really not that attractive. But with the PlayStation headset, you just plug in the USB dongle and it just works. So for me, that's, like, a huge win. I still recommend it. I still have to, like...
Compatible with other things other than PS3?
Yeah, you can... it comes with a wireless... it comes with a headphone jack, so mm-hmm. you can actually plug it into, like, a Vita or your iPod or
but
whatever.
But it doesn't do any mixing or anything like that.
You know, I haven't tried that yet. You can turn it on, and I think it'll do the bass thing, but I don't think it'll have any virtual... Yeah, it won't have virtual surround sound.
What's the sticker price on?
It's pricey. It's $150.
It's a little stout.
Yeah, that's pretty pricey. But they're not discontinuing last year's model. And to be honest, I don't think... So the new model that they're introducing this year introduced, like... I forget what they call it, but it's like... it's essentially rumble packs for your ears.
Yeah, it buzzes when you, like, get low bass, right?
And, like, it's sort of interesting, but on the other hand, I don't think it's really adding anything to the experience.
The look on your face, is sort of interesting is generous.
Like,
it's because I want my head shaking when I'm listening to
something. Like, it's not as powerful as I thought it would be. I think if it were, like, any more, like, intense, it would just be, like, I'm getting punched in the ears all the time. Thankfully, it's not that. But, like, it's just weird... When you're used to, like, a proper surround sound setup and you feel, like, the bass kick in...
Yes.
Your entire body feels that.
Yeah, true.
But when it's just your ears feeling that, it's just, like, a really bizarre sensation. So, you know, if last year's model, which doesn't include the rumble packs for your ears, mm-hmm. If I'm assuming they're pretty much on par with each other. You know,
so you can still go for that.
Yeah, and it's cheaper. They're not discontinuing it. So.
Good sound. Can't beat it. Although I have to say, you brought up mix. The 5.1 for Borderlands, not that great. They didn't mix the center channel.
You know, I've been playing it all on an Astro headset on PC, so I haven't, because I've been playing co-op with David Ellis. And
I thought my center channel was out because I got all set up. But anyway, James Stevenson, what's your finishing move?
Well, after we talked a little bit about FTL and being kind of like a board game, I thought I'd give a shout-out to Stooge from NeoGAF and his Pandasaurus Games company, their latest Kickstarter, another rare out-of-print game that everyone loves, Lost Valley. It's actually funded with, like, 28 days to go. They're after their stretch goals now. But if you're a big board gamer, you should check it out.
If you give us the link, we will stick that into the
I will do that. It's pretty cool. It's a game where you go explore, like, Alaska looking for gold, and it's an actual exploration board game where as your characters move out, the board grows, and it's different every time you play. So pretty cool stuff. Definitely check it out.
Jeff Mattis.
Yes. So on the iOS front this week, a Rayman Jungle Run came out. And it's a one-button platformer, I guess. It's not really technically an endless free runner because it's broken into stages. But it's got if you like the trademark, you know, Rayman art, it's one of the most gorgeous looking games I've seen on the iPad.
I mean, yeah, they just put the entire UbiArt framework on the iOS.
Yeah, it looks brilliant. Yeah, and it's, I mean, the gameplay is, you know, despite being a one button platformer, you're pretty much running all the time in one direction. He kind of auto corrects based on the way he's supposed to run the flow of the level. You're collecting the looms or lums or whatever they're called as you go through, and that's sort of the high score chasing mechanic, is to collect all those. There's like a dark world or a dead world you can unlock, but yeah, I mean it's run, jump, and then you eventually unlock other abilities, like the ability to run up walls or use his little propeller ear things to like glide through.
It's Rayman,
and it feels like Rayman, and it feels like a great iOS port of not port, but iOS rendition of a Rayman game. $3, you know, really
very cool.
Yeah, very cool.
I have saved a quick minute on F1 for this moment. Unfortunately, we don't really have any other racers right here to talk about it, so I'll just give you this update on F1. I think that I have reached a realization for me in racing games that F1 is – that I may be like done trying to play F1 games, and I'll be just happy watching F1 on television. And here's the reason why. It's not because this F1 game is bad. Actually, I would say that most of the things that I've read online, I will confirm. First of all, it plays fantastic with controller. It's clear they put a lot of work into getting the controllers, the controller controls down right. Although I'm really a little put off that there's no fine-tuning for those controls in the option menus that I've been able to find. Like, I can't find a place to give myself a little more center wheel dead zone. Because, like, I want a little more dead zone. These damn thing, the cars go 100, go 208, 212 in a heartbeat. I want a little more dead zone in the steering wheel. That having been said, the thing about F1, and a couple of you have already asked me this, is, you know, how do you get better at it? And the reality of this is that you're talking about machines that drive differently than cars. And I really love sports car racing, and I wish someone would go do a sports car racing game like we used to get, like the 24 Hours of Le Mans for Dreamcast and Race Driver, where they were all about racing in sports cars. But I still like the way a sports car drives. I like weight shift. I like not having all that downforce. I like having to drive the car. And I'm not saying you don't have to drive the car here. It's just it's so much different. And everything happens at such incredible speeds, even in a virtual case. To get good at F1, it's real simple. Go drive practice laps. And then go drive some more practice laps. And then go drive some more practice laps. Because you have to learn how to cope with this car that goes incredibly fast. Even with assists, you're going to have to learn where do you make the turn in coming down into the chicane, and where do you want to use your brakes, and how much can you get on the gas coming out of things. And it's not – I mean, I've been driving sporting cars in real world for 30 years. So, and I've driven, you know, heavy torque steer front-wheel drivers. I've driven V8 rear-wheel drivers. I've driven turbo cars. I've driven a bunch of cars, and I have a really, you know, at least I have a sensibility in my head of like what a car should feel like driving it, pushing it a little bit. But F1, all bets are off. You're sitting in this sled that's right down on the ground with tremendous amounts of downforce, where the faster you go, the harder the car sticks to the ground. So the stuff that just doesn't make sense, where you're like going through a big, broad, sweeping turn, like you don't want to get off the gas. You want to keep down. You want to keep the hammer down. But then you make the slightest little mistake and you're off in the kitty litter, because that corner that's coming up at you, it's not coming up at you at 120 or 130 or 150 miles an hour. It's coming up at you at like 200 and something miles an hour. But then you're down to 30 miles an hour, and then you're at 80, and then you're at 50, and then you're at 150, and then you're at 30. And the only way to master this is like – so anyway, the point of all this is if you're really into F1, I think that they have done another beautiful job with the game. It looks fantastic. It has full race weekends. It has all the things you would want, although it's a little strange when you're playing in a career that – I mean, I guess it makes sense. When you're playing in career, you're going to have time to settle in for a race, because the shortest race you can run is 25% of total laps. So it's going to take you at least half an hour, and you can't save mid-race. Yeah, it's kind of annoying. Wow. So you need to like...
You got to plan for that.
You're going to have some time. Like,
it's kind of like Madden or something in that regard, where it's going to take a while to play a game.
But you know what? Here's the difference. Is like Madden is like, if you've been playing football, you can sit down and play Madden and have fun with it, and there's room for mistakes. Like
F1 is full concentration the whole time.
Yeah, and if there's 14 turns in a lap of a track, and you're going to run 60 laps of that sucker, that's oh my God, what is that like?
Yeah, that's like a lot of turns.
840 turns?
Yeah,
this is why I stick to Mario Kart.
That's 840 something, some odd turns, where you make a mistake and you're screwed. I mean, you're going to lose enough time in that mistake,
throw the whole race away.
That's going to really throw your race away. But that's the thing about F1 is like knowing when you can push, when you can't push. One thing I've learned is that, I mean, they're definitely into like tire temperature modeling. When you come out on cold tires, you better be careful with those cold tires. So you get them up to temperature, they're just not right. And the switch between the inters and the primes is now I'm like speaking geek term, but like the switch is right. You can really tell the difference there. Anyway, I'll play it a little more, but I think that I've learned that I'm a sports car racer, and I love my sporting car games. I want something that's like 24 Hours at Le Mans was on Dreamcast, or Race Driver, or has these sort of race buildups, but with sports cars. All right, folks, there you go. Thanks to James from Insomniac for joining us, and Andrew and Jeff, of course. Thanks to the crew, Micah and Dave in the studio here, and everybody, all the fan of us hosting here at Atlantis Group Studios in Santa Monica. That is your Weekend Confirmed. Don't worry, we do have my shame coming up. I'm going to be ridiculed tremendously if you stick around afterwards for the tailgate, because it's just been a disastrous football week for me. But anyway, there you go. That's your Weekend Confirmed, and we are Ghost. Work so hard that you know we play harder. Work so hard that you know we play harder. Yeah, come on. It took a minute for me to see what was going down. My body's vibrating, pulsating to the sound. Hey, bartender, hit me with another round. I gotta feel she's ready. This episode is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. Find over 20 million stock photos, vectors, illustrations, and video clips. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code WeekendConfirmed9. All right, time to get into the tailgate. I have no idea why I'm excited, because I am just like crashing and burning. First of all, I'm a very, very horrible 0-6 against
tough start.
Kanata and I are in a full season pick'em league where I'm like almost as bad. I'm at like 29% for the season. Like, I don't know. I can't pick against the line for shit this season. Like,
you could throw a dart at the line and do better than what you're doing.
Yeah, but and what's really nice is the guy who runs it and flips a coin on all the games each week.
Leading.
And the coin is kicking my ass.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, last week, Jeff Kanata at 2-1, and then everybody else except for me at 1-2, and I was the cellar dweller at 0-3, putting me at 0-6 for the season. I'm primed for a big comeback.
It's not over. It's only week 2.
It's not over yet. Kanata still in the lead there at 4-2. Dave, Micah, and our guest. Who was our guest? Who's the guest one?
I just put that in there because every week we have a guest on.
You're at 2-4. Andrea started off at 1-. How's she 1-3 after 1-2? She's 1-2.
1-2. That's a
Andrea started off at 1-2, but she was so enthusiastic about it that she's picking an extra game for the next 3 weeks to catch up, so she'll have the right number. And then I'm there at 0-6. So, and by the way, we'll do fantasy catch up here at the end. Should we do fantasy real quick? We'll do fantasy real quick. Jeff and I both came in. I had it written down here someplace. Jeff and I both came in winners this week. How do you like that?
Same here. I'm kicking ass in that fantasy.
You didn't include it on here.
I didn't see it in there. Where was it? I didn't see it on
there. Oh, here it is. It's right here. So Jeff and I were both winners last week. I won in the West 117-78 over Cutler's Bad Fur Day on the backs of Eli and Trent Richardson. Jeff chalked up his first win over Love Shack with Reggie Bush.
He killed it.
Yeah, he had a great game.
With Reggie Bush and Hakeem Nicks. So,
Hakeem Nicks killed it for me this week. Thank you.
In the West, the one who knocks took over in Division 1, and Harbossum stays atop Division 2 in the West. And then in the East, my damn team beat the Gorillas 99.95-57. I also had I had Hakeem Nicks in that league, so Hakeem Nicks was a big player. And he's out Thursday night.
Yeah, that killed me. Damn. I didn't sit him.
And Jeff also chalked up his win there against the New Jersey Solid Snakes, 115-75, and that he did on the backs of Cam Newton and Trent Richardson. Congratulations to the Goodyear Daleks, who take over in Division 1, and the Animagi, who take over in the other division there. So, but I'm 2-0 in both of those leagues. I'm just going to say that. I'm 2-0 there, unlike the Pick'ems. All right, so here we go. This week's games. Oh, by the way, you get to gloat. So,
oh, yeah. Seahawks, baby. Yeah, baby. We got the Packers this week, so we'll see how good we really are. But Arizona made us look better because they went into New England and beat them. So now I'm feeling pretty good about the Hawks. NFC West is
Russell
come
Wilson,
on.
Man.
That was, by the way, the most amazing thing, because it saved the Cowboys from being the real goat loser of the, like, like New England losing to the Cardinals was how many people lost
the Saints losing again?
How many people messed up their suicide pools?
I'm sure there's
it was
a
like
lot of
30-40% generally. It was like it just wiped out. It wiped out suicide pools that game.
Just totally, or at least got the buy-ins up because everyone's like, okay, I'm buying back in. It's early in the season. I'll drop another 20 on
I believe it's the first time since like 2002, 2003 that every team in the NFC West won on the same week.
Wow.
Nice.
Wow. All right, so here we go with this week's selections. And by the way, I'm kind of like, I'm going to start rotating in and out Dallas and Seattle and San Francisco, so we aren't always picking all the same ones. But after that collapse, I had to put the Cowboys back in here. This is, it's their home opener weekend, but boy, the line here is a real, it's a real challenging line to pick against. It is Tampa Bay Buccaneers getting 8 points on the road at Dallas's home opener. You know, I'm telling you, I gotta back my boys, but this is a very tough one not to go with. But I'll tell you why I'm backing them. I'm backing them because I think that at the wide receiver position, Tampa Bay is sort of one dimensional still. I mean, look, Mike's okay, but really, this is their Vincent Jackson team. I think that the Cowboys can use their good defensive backfield to lock those guys down and cheat the run, put eight guys in the box all the time. And I think they can beat Tampa Bay pretty solidly and bounce back here.
Not so fast, my friend. No, that was Miley Corso. I think Cardinals are still overrated. I think Seattle is unfortunately still overrated.
You son of a...
And I think Dallas is way overrated, not that great. I do think Dallas wins this game, but...
But not by eight.
Not by eight. Tampa Bay covers. It's maybe a field goal game, and Tampa Bay is going to take this game.
I can feel you on your cover. I can feel you on your cover. Dave, what do you think?
I'm a little nervous about the cover there, but I think Dallas being at home, losing pretty bad to Seattle last week, I think they bounce back. You know, I hope so. Otherwise, I think.
So what are you saying? You're gonna lay the eight. You're gonna give them the eight.
Yeah, against my better judgment, I am, because they're at home. I think that's I think they're coming out hot.
All right,
this is hot.
Jeff Mattis, are you picking with us today?
Sure, I'll pick with you today.
All right,
I'm kind of in James's camp actually. I would give them the win. Because if I think they don't, you know, they got to be fired up after last week.
I would hope so.
So, because of that, I think they'll win. I don't think they're gonna cover that spread though. I don't think they're gonna do
so
that.
So you're going to Bucks.
Yeah. All right, that's fair. Micah, where are you headed with this one? He lived in Tampa, so he's a Tampa fan. He's going with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. I'm having a little trouble opening my email right now, so in just a minute we'll have Andrea and Jess pick. In the meantime, we will move right on to this game, which was to me the most interesting game of the week to pick. That would be Houston Texans on the road going into New Mile High to take on the Denver Broncos, with the Texans having to give up 2 points. So the Broncos are at home and they're getting points. I mean, look, come on. Just because you've got Arian Foster, just because you're like haven't given up, you know, so look. Like, just because you haven't given up over 200 yards passing or two touchdowns in two games, I'm not buying this. I am all over Denver on this one.
Not so fast, my friend. I'm exactly the opposite. This game opened in favor of Denver. Line has swung the other way pretty hard. Sharps are big on Houston. I think Peyton Manning last week, you saw how the rust is not off. He looked terrible in the first quarter.
Oh, come
on.
And
now he's going to be playing the NFL's best defense in Houston.
He threw a
best
few
defense?
Bad interceptions.
No, it's a good defense.
They're
up there, though.
The pressure is there. Like, they're not missing Mario at all. The pressure is definitely there.
I think that they get to Peyton Manning, and Houston not only wins, they cover the spread. They're going to probably win by a touchdown. Houston over Denver.
I see. This is a tough one for me, but I got to go with Denver at home, especially after Manning coming out playing so bad. I got a feeling he's going to come out on fire.
Big day for Willis McGahee, too.
So, I got to go Denver.
I also am going to go Denver for that reason, I think.
They're lining up for you to clean up here, Jeff.
I know.
I mean, Jim.
I know.
Like,
I'm calling
you
chair,
Jeff.
I know.
Like, you're like in Jeff's chair. What do you think, Micah? He's with Denver as well. And now I have my email up here, so I can give you the picks. Kanata is on Tampa Bay, not surprisingly, because he hates me. The guys, you're not here.
He always picks against Dallas.
And he's also on the Broncos.
Okay.
And Andrea is up on the Cowboys over the Bucks. She's going to drop those points, and she's got the Texans.
So Andrea and I.
Over the Broncos.
I hope Andrea and I are right. That'd be awesome.
Sunday night, those New England Patriots licking their chops are getting 3 points going into the Baltimore Ravens home field. Okay, look, the Baltimore Ravens defense is not the Ravens defense it used to be. This is ridiculous. This is New England's game all the way. They have, look, they, yes, they're missing Hernandez, but they have too many weapons. They're going to keep Baltimore on their heels. They're going to get their act back together. They're going to be so fired up coming off that Cardinals loss. I bet if there were statistics, I wonder how long it's been since
they've
lost back to back, especially like that. And like add all the other things in there, like against the NFC West. And like, no way. I will absolutely take those 3 points and the Patriots.
Not so fast, my friend. Triple not so fast. I am all over Baltimore here because you know what? My transitive property of Seattle's being overrated, Arizona's overrated, New England's overrated, Baltimore.
Not overrated?
Baltimore, not overrated. Baltimore wins at home.
Oh,
hates
come on.
New England. They're psyched up for this game. They're ready to go. New England exposed last week against Arizona, and I go all against Garnett's picks this week. Going 0-9. That's where you're headed right now.
Don't count it out.
Yes. You gotta go Flacco versus Brady. I mean, come on. Like, Brady can't have... I think he's got to pull it out. I think Baltimore's good, and they're going to be super tough at home, and this is kind of... I'm on the fence on this one, but I got to go New England.
All right.
Yeah. And I also think this is pretty close to a coin flip, but I'm going Pats.
All right. And then, Micah, where are you going to head with this one? He's going with the Patriots as well. Mr. Jeff Cannata has the Baltimore Ravens.
That's right.
This is not boding well for me. And Andrea also has the Baltimore Ravens.
I'm feeling good about Andrea's picks this week.
I know.
Well, besides Dallas.
Yeah.
But.
And then the extra pick that we had to throw Andrea's way.
I want to pick this one too.
You need
to catch up.
I didn't. Okay, you want to pick this one to catch up? Well, I need the line for you. Or do you care about the line? The line.
Well, I do.
It's
eight. It's eight.
No, I know what it is. It's eight.
Okay.
It's the Niners going into Minnesota, and it's the Niners. Yeah. It's nine. I picked it for. Like, come on, it's Andrea and Jeff.
Well, did Andrea pick? Did Andrea Homer pick this?
Of course she did.
I got a Homer pick this too. I'm a 49ers fan. I got to go straight up against Andrea. So 49ers cover. 49ers
cover
eight.
They're going to cover.
They're going to beat them by 10.
They're going to cover eight on the road.
One of the best teams in football.
They're
49ers
beat them
right
by
now.
Like 14. Or
have
21.
You seen Adrian Peterson running?
So have you seen the 49ers defense?
Yeah.
49ers.
Yeah,
49ers.
Dude, they
win.
Shut down two. Can they do three in a row? Come on, Peterson looks good.
I don't think they've had a person rush over 100 yards at all.
They certainly haven't. But
8 or 9 games.
49ers. That's. I'll catch up, and I'm playing all season this year. We'll see how it goes.
All right. So you're now on the email chain as well.
I'm on the email chain as well. So 49ers.
All right. You're gonna have to pick even longer because you're coming in like 2 weeks late.
You're 2 weeks back now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll.
So
we'll.
Yeah.
So you're gonna have to go six extra picks.
All right.
We'll figure
it
out.
Yeah. We'll work
it out. All right, everybody. There you go. Hope you enjoy a great weekend. Hope your team does fantastic. Stay out of trouble. Have a lot of fun. And we will come back next week where I will be 3-6.